Should not be on the schedule for 24:30 a.m., but we'll do it on Monday or gonna do it that quick. I can say that we can say, okay. Oh yeah, Monday. So we're gonna open a public hearing for House Bill 2440A. And Representative Montgomery, did you come to this bill? And Senator Trost? Are there any, and Representative Edwards, are there any other legislators? Yes, I would like him to come up. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. We'll be very brief. I know you have a busy schedule and you'd like to get home, but we have to go over and sit around here for a couple more hours, so we just going to be with you. However, my name is Bob Montgomery, District 56 from Cascade Locks. House Bill 2440A is just a number, but it can mean so much for the youth of our state. Senator Troll and I each got together about November of last year accidentally because we both dropped some information to Legislative Council regarding this team driver. They asked if we'd work together if we'd like to, and the answer was yes. And then we found out Representative Edwards is involved in it too, so we just combined it into one bill, and that's where we are right now. I think we have a rare chance to take a step that will save a lot of young lives. House Bill 2440 is a graduated licensing bill. It applies only to 16 and 17-year-olds. You'll have some people behind us testifying on it. There are going to be those who say House Bill 2440 is not strict enough, and then there's going to be those who say House Bill 2440 is too strict. Based on the phone calls I've been receiving, I've had a few people think it's not a good bill. Most of them are 14 and 15-year-olds, unfortunately. But their parents think it's a good bill. I think it'll save some lives. I think it's a well-thought-out bill. We've put a lot of hours into it, combined here together, and would like to ask you to support it for us and help us move it forward. And I feel very comfortable this will save some lives. I mean it sincerely. Thank you very much for hearing our bill. We appreciate it.
Senator Shannon and members of the committee, I'm Senator Tro from District 18. This bill really gets at, I think, a very crucial problem. Drivers under the age of 19 are involved in fatal injury crashes at nearly twice the rate as the population as a whole. Traffic crashes are the leading cause of death among 15 to 20-year-olds. The crash rates for 16-year-olds drivers are by far the highest of any age group, 1.5 times higher than for 17-year-olds, 3 times higher for that of drivers age 18 to 19, 4.3 times higher than that of drivers from ages 20 to 24. There are just lots of fatalities, and this bill, I think, will save lives. It points at a real problem. It points at the problem of young people driving at night. There are more fatalities at night for this young group than any other time, and so we sort of point at that, and I think we've come to the conclusion that beginning drivers should be introduced gradually to the driving experience. They should be provided the maximum time to practice under the safest possible real world conditions with an experienced adult helping them learn. They should be given the opportunity to gradually develop the skills that they need for full licensure. This bill allows beginning drivers to gain valuable experience before they're exposed to potentially dangerous situations of having a lot of passengers that they're driving around. So it starts off with the driver, it gets good training for the driver, and gradually the drivers are allowed to have other young passengers in the car, but they don't start out doing it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Representative from House District 15 in Southeast Portland, and I appreciate the opportunity to have been able to work with the two other members who spoke earlier. Again, I think I just want to underscore that the provisional driver's license idea is a very good idea. It is a teen safety idea. It is a simple concept, and it's not unique. It is unique that Oregon is going a little farther here for Oregon. But it's not unique to Oregon. In fact, many other states have adopted similar types of restrictions on young drivers. The concept is simple as to describe a Senator Trell. It's just to show that young drivers can demonstrate responsible driving. We have, I believe, crafted a good bill to make sure that there are certain exceptions. For example, if a young driver has a family member and they're going to take them to school, that they can do that. Family members are exempt, so, and work situations are exempt. But there are restrictions of time when drivers, young drivers, can either have certain passengers and a time restriction at night. Again, studies have shown that by placing these restrictions, that you do have concrete results. Not only is it an issue of lethal accidents, as was described earlier, but teen drivers are involved in millions of non-lethal accidents, and you'll probably hear a little more of those statistics, and we kind of understand why that is. Largely, it is driven by the fact that they are less experienced. They're also risk takers, and they expose themselves to greater risks in the car. When you look around the world, actually New Zealand is seems to be the leader in restricting when teen drivers can drive, and they have seen a dramatic drop in accidents to the tune of 23% from ages 15 to 19. Florida recently put in a similar graduated driving system, graduated license system, in which it, for 16-year-olds, have seen a decrease by 19% in fatalities and 25% in other accidents. So what we're trying to do simply is to help save lives and also save injury, and to help the general public from the risks that are being taken by young drivers. It's a good bill. Hope you can have a work session soon and pass it on.
Hey, we have some amendments, and I hope that you take, you know, each get a copy. Sure. We have enough, Gary, because I want you to see, we're going to have, I don't know, 9 or 10 people testify after you, but one thing that we learned when we were working on Senate bill was that the statistics show that when driver's ed goes into the school, that the accidents have historically increased. And however, if you have the children, the students enrolled in a driver's training class approved by Department of Transportation, it has different statistics. They have a different emphasis, which I think part of it is more actual driving experience. And I noticed that this amendment does turn it over to the Department of Transportation. And I'm not sure, but Kelly Taylor will testify, but it seems to me that there may be available, you know, that they have, last I heard, it was $82 million in their safety. And they may qualify for some matching funds or some federal funds to help. I'm not sure. But this does kind of change the bill. And before we work it, I would appreciate if you'd give me your reaction to it. Okay, because we won't work it till I'll back before I schedule. I'll call you and see what you think. And I know it's not right to ask you to comment right now, so I just hand it to you. Yes, Senator?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, the three of you. And Senator Crow has already heard you use this number a couple of times, but one of the things I noticed when I got to the back page 4, and noticed they're repeatedly talking about the seatbelt issue with young people, and I was startled about a month ago when I heard on the radio that over the last 10 years, 60,000 teenagers have lost their lives in automobiles, and the real startling part was 40,800 of them were not seatbelts. So I really appreciate the focus here, saying, you know, we're going to hold you to be accountable for wearing those seatbelts. If you blow up with that violation, the consequences are going to be severe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator George. We will give the Representative Edwards credit for that. That's his participation in the bill. His name is in a plus a lot of other things.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Does anyone else have a question of this panel? Okay.
I'm sure. I just like to thank you for having the hearing, and hopefully we can have a productive work session. I want to thank the chair of the House Transportation Committee for the tremendous job he's done with the bill now. I think the bill is in really good shape to begin with, so give a good thought to it.
Okay, well, we will. We're going to work it. It's my intention. Thank you. Okay. Then, Marsha Latta, is she still in here? I just want to ask you a question. I know you didn't find out and you helped us on the other bill. Would you also take a look at the amendments? And I'd like to know what your comments are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll have an opportunity to talk to you later.
If you're not ready tonight, then tomorrow.
I would like to share it with the administrator of our program.
Okay. Thank you. Ted Farr. What? Oh, just a second, Ted. You should sit down there a second. We have two bills that we could just kick out of here, and they wouldn't have to stay all this time.
Okay.
So I'm going to suspend the public hearing on House Bill 2440A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2740A. Daryl, you want to come up here? Daryl Fuller. You want to tell us about
the Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2740A limits the liability of persons that loan, rent, donate, or otherwise makes available motor vehicles used by another person pursuant to a written agreement. Specifies that person making motor vehicle available is not liable for injury, death, or damage that results from use of the motor vehicle, except if injury, death, or damage results from negligent maintenance. And it specifies that this limitation of liability applies only if the person providing the vehicle is engaged in the business of selling or being leasing or repairing motor vehicles.
Okay. Go ahead, Bill.
Chair Shannon, members of the committee, thank you for hearing this bill. It comes from the House with only 3 votes in opposition and with no testimony in opposition in the Commerce Committee once the bill was amended. You have my written testimony. I'll summarize it rather than read it. If you go out and you rent a car, they offer you insurance. If you take that insurance, the insurance covers the rental car. If you elect not to use that insurance, then when you sign the rental contract, you are indicating that you're responsible for the vehicle if it gets into an accident, and that any insurance covering you as an individual will cover an accident that you get into as the driver of that rented vehicle. So you take your rented car and you get into a wreck that you're responsible for. You run a red light, you hit somebody. You would think that your insurance company would cover the cost of repairing that vehicle. But in fact, in the case law, your insurance company only pays half of the cost of repairing that vehicle, and my dealer's insurance company pays half of the cost of repairing that vehicle. And the reason why is because the legislature has never directed which insurance is primary and which insurance is secondary. And every insurance policy has a clause in it that says if there's any other insurance available, we want the other insurance to go first. So when a rented car gets into an accident, the first thing the driver's insurance company does is get a hold of their attorneys. And their attorneys call my insurance company's attorneys, and they say, we only have to pay for half of this. What we're asking the legislature to do is to clearly state in a statute that the insurance of the driver is the primary insurance, and the insurance of the company providing the vehicle is secondary insurance, because it's the driver that gets into the accident, not the vehicle. Now, there is an exception in there if there is something wrong with the vehicle, if the vehicle breaks or fails, or somehow the dealer is negligent in providing the vehicle, then we would become responsible. But if the driver is responsible for the accident, then it's the driver's insurance that ought to be responsible for repairing the vehicle. And that is only if your insurance company covers rental cars. Okay? If your personal insurance policy does not have a rental car coverage, then this wouldn't affect you. It's only affect you if you have rental car coverage. So that's the first part of the bill. It would clearly state that the driver's insurance is primary and the dealership's insurance is secondary. By the way, there are 21 other states that have passed laws similar to that. There are 3 states that have passed laws making the dealership insurance primary. So we're going the same direction as most other states are going. The second part of the bill covers the circumstances when your vehicle is in the shop for repair, and the repair facility provides you with a loaner vehicle. Okay. At that time, when your car is in our shop, we're responsible for your vehicle, which means if it gets damaged in our shop or while we're road testing your vehicle, we're completely responsible for your car while it's in our shop. If we provide you with a loaner vehicle, we're 50% responsible for that loaner vehicle. At that same time, your insurance company gets a vacation, because your car is in our shop and we're responsible for it. So for the period of time your car is in our shop, your insurance company has no obligation at all.
So what this bill says is if your car is in the shop for repair or service and we provide you with a loaner vehicle, that your primary insurance transfers to the loaner vehicle. So that your primary insurance covers the primary vehicle that you're driving at the time that your primary vehicle is in the shop. We've discussed this with the insurance lobby. They have no opposition to it. We ran it by the Department of Justice. We ran it by the consumer groups. Nobody has any opposition to the idea of clarifying Oregon law as to which insurance is primary and which insurance is excess, because it simply is not discussed in Oregon law at all. So you're happy to answer any questions that you have about the bill.
Question?
Madam Chair, in the latter scenario that you just, does it also have the same exception for if there's something faulty with the car? Say you take your car in and you're given a car to drive, and then the brakes go out in that car that you're driving. So what would result in that in terms of insurance coverage?
I believe the way the bill is written is that exemption would cover any vehicle that a rental car company would provide to you. The way the liability is written is that the renting company doesn't have liability unless they're negligent in loaning or renting the vehicle.
Okay.
So if we're negligent by providing you with a vehicle that has faulty brakes, or if we're negligent by loaning you a vehicle and you're clearly intoxicated, in both cases we would be held liable if there is negligence on the part of the renting agency.
Thank you. Okay. No more questions? Are we going to close the work session? Yes.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
How was the vote in the House?
I don't remember how many people were not present. There were 3 no votes, one Republican and 2 Democrats, and something like 54 or 55 I votes. I believe there was 1 or 2 members absent.
Why was, do you understand the reasons for the opposition?
No, they made no statements during the floor session on why they opposed the bill, and gave no indication to me why they did. And frankly, I haven't had a chance to visit with them and ask.
Follow-up question.
Yes.
What about in the House Committee? Were there any opposition?
The only opposition to the House Committee was from Representative Jim Hill, the Commerce Chair, and he indicated to me that he hadn't had enough time to look at the bill more carefully in terms of the transfer of liability from one insurance carrier to another, and because he had enough time to spend with it as he wanted to, that he was going to vote no.
Oh, but he supported the bill on the floor.
No, he was one of the 3 no votes on the floor.
Oh,
Representative Hill, Representative Rosenbaum, and Representative Devlin, if I remember correctly.
Bowman.
Was it Bowman? Excuse me, thank you. Bowman.
Oh, I see. So you're going to make the driver's insurance the primary insurance under this bill.
The driver's insurance would be primary if your primary vehicle is in a shop for repair. That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, I didn't introduce myself for the record, and I apologize. Okay. I'm Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association.
And so if it's in repair in the shop and the driver is driving a loaner's car, the driver's insurance is primary.
That's correct. Under any circumstances, that would be the case. If you're just renting a vehicle because you're going on vacation, then your insurance would be primary if your insurance had rental car coverage provided. If your personal rental or your personal auto insurance policy included coverage for rental cars, then that insurance would be primary if you got into an accident and you were responsible for that accident.
But if you don't have the coverage in your own private insurance, then the rental car insurance covers you.
Chair Shannon, Senator Yee, that is my understanding. If your policy specifically excludes rental cars, then it would not cover an accident to rent a car.
Mm-hmm. Is it pretty standard to cover rental cars?
Chair Shannon, Senator Yee, it depends on the kind of policy you have. If you have a comprehensive policy, then generally it does carry it. If you have just the legal limits required by Oregon statute, generally those don't carry rental car coverage.
So if it's not covered, then the rental company's insurance is primary.
Chair Shannon, Senator Yee, that would be correct, although if you sign a rental contract saying you're responsible for the vehicle, a rental agency would have the ability to take you to court because you signed a contract indicating that you would be responsible for the vehicle while it was in your care.
Mm-hmm.
In most cases, dealerships prefer to just eat the cost of repairs rather than sue a customer.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, we can close the hearing on House Bill 2740A. Open a work session on House Bill 2740-A.
Madam Chairman, I'll move House Bill 2740-A to the floor with a big pass recommendation.
Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, the only thing is this probably doesn't affect me, but even so, just to be careful, my husband occasionally does advertising for car dealers, so I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest on this bill.
Okay. What's the name of this firm?
He just he freelances.
Okay. 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 The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Having received the unanimous vote, House Bill 2748 goes to the floor with a due pass. And Senator Farioli, will you carry the bill?
Madam Chairman, I will carry the bill, and I will also tell Paul that he missed an opportunity to have his firm's name mentioned on the internet where millions of people can heard. Millions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Short session on House Bill 2740. Now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2559. And there's a lady here. Yes, Kate, from Representative Shetterly's office.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2559 authorizes the use of vehicle immobilization devices in addition to boots to be used by law enforcement if the court orders a vehicle to be immobilized.
Okay.
Hi. For the record, Kate Richards from Legislative Aid for Representative Lane Shetterly, House District 34, and he is out on the floor right now in the House. This is a very tiny little bill, just changes a couple of words. We're all familiar with the boot. I hope that's not personal experience. But this bill would allow some smaller jurisdictions to use other immobilization devices other than a boot. They are very expensive, and some of the smaller cities just have a hard time affording it, but they may need to immobilize a vehicle. So, and the only example I can give you actually of another immobilization device would be the club as seen on TV. But that is exactly what some of the smaller cities are looking at using. And we didn't have any opposition to this bill on the other side, and we would ask that you would pass it on to the Senate floor.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Actually, Madam Chairman, I was wondering what a different immobilization device might be. I mean, are we just talking about changing chaining a 40-gallon galvanized garbage can to the bed?
Sure, Senator Farioli, and indeed that may qualify under this bill. We just are using the word device, and I think that would qualify. However, I think it's unlikely.
Madam Chairman, it worked at our high school.
where would that be?
High school in Portland.
Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2559. Open the first session on House Bill 2559.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2559 to the floor with a due pass.
Any discussion? The clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Hill?
Aye.
Senator Hill?
Aye.
Senator
Gore?
Aye.
Senator Aye. Having received a majority vote, it goes to the floor with a due pass. Senator George, did you
carry the floor? I sure will. I can mobilize the car real quick.
Okay. And that closes the work session on House Bill 2559.
First, Madam Chairman, it was the principal's car that we used to immobilize with the judge.
Sure confession. Okay. That's great. Okay, now we'll go back to you. And House Bill 2448, open a public hearing. Thank you. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here this evening on behalf of the Oregon Fire and Medical Administrators and the Oregon Association to testify in strong support for House Bill 2448. I've been a paramedic in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, for the last 20 years. I'm a member of both of these organizations, who are public and providers, public and private providers of emergency medics for the country. We group in young people who have some disability associated with accidents that are associated with driving. The fact is that young people between the ages of 15 and 20 make up a disproportionate share of auto accident victims. And in addition to by others, so I won't belabor the point. Other than to say that it isn't just deaths that we're working at, looking at, although statistics that are right out of our report is limited. It doesn't have to do in as much with the driving experience, the hours of driving with other people in the vehicle that I think are all important indicators when you look at the statistics that we have in front of us here. Motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death to teenagers. Although they represent 6% of the driving population, they make up 14% of the fatalities. The majority of those fatalities occur between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. So there's a disproportionate amount there. And 5% of teenage passenger deaths occur with other teens driving vehicles. On a more personal level, my son's 15 years old, February 8th, and this bill was under discussion. And I had a fairly lengthy discussion with him, and he had a lengthy discussion with his comrades at school. And they had a recent experience where one of their classmates was involved in a severe auto accident where another teenager was badly injured. In light of that discussion and his personal experience, he had no problem with the bill as it was outlined. The way that it was outlined by the time actually made sense to restrict the number of people in the experience. We also have an agreement between ourselves that we will align with the
possibility of you can't beat a good parent. All the laws, huh? Okay, yeah, question. I would just like to read into the record that at the same time they handed out your testimony, they handed out one from Bruce Hoffman, a sergeant with the Oregon State Patrol Services Division, and it seems that the Oregon State Police are at, support this bill also. So, okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, Renee Christensen and Ashley Graves and Susan Moore.
We appreciate you guys hearing us. I want to introduce you to three boys, and I'll take these down in a moment. Very close to us. Susie's son, Justin Moore. This is my son, Matthew Gray, and my husband's son, Brett Christensen. Put these down, please. All three of these boys are pulling car accidents. And we come here for each other. We come here to encourage you to pass the bill. Our son died. We really need this man. In the accident where my son and my husband's son were killed, my husband's son was Brett, and my son was Matt. Brett was driving the car. He was 16. He'd had his license 5 months. He had his car, you know, the same amount of time. They were all out on their first date. They had a couple girls in the car, and they were taking them home. They'd been out and had a fun evening, and there was no hurry. They had plenty of time. They were a mile or so from the girls' house. 10 minutes to go. They had plenty of time, though he was going to be late. For some reason, Brett crossed the center line and hit another car head-on, and it killed both the boys. It killed the man they hit. And seriously and critically injured the girls. One of the girls will never be the same. It's affected our families unbelievably. It's affected our friends. It's affected our town. To give you an idea of what happened to our town that weekend, the next morning, less than 9 hours later, there were two more kids killed from our high school. In an accident up on the pass, they hit ice and flipped and hit another car. And two of the three girls in the car were killed, and the family they hit were injured but sent home the same day. And so, although I don't bring... My name is Meg Christensen, and we appreciate you guys hearing us. I want to introduce you to three boys, and I'll take these down in a moment. Very close to us.
Susie Simon, Justin Moore, my son, Matthew Gray, and my husband's son, Brett Christensen.
Put these down, please.
All three of these boys have been in car accidents.
And,
we come here for each other. We come here to, encourage you to have this girl. Our son is dying. We really need her today.
In the accident where my son and my husband's son were killed, my husband's son was Brett, and my son was Matt. Brett was driving the car. He was 16. He'd had his license 5 months. He had his car, you know, the same amount of time. They were all out on their first date. They had a couple girls in the car, and they were taking them home. They'd been out and had a fun evening. And there was no hurry. They had plenty of time. They were a mile or so from the girls' house. 10 minutes to go. They had plenty of time. Nobody was going to be late. For some reason, Brett crossed the center line and hit another car head-on. And it killed both the boys. It killed the man they hit. And seriously and critically injured the girls. One of the girls will never be the same. It's affected our families unbelievably. It's affected our friends. It's affected our town. To give you an idea of what happened to our town that weekend, the next morning, less than 9 hours later, there were two more kids killed from our high school. In an accident up on the pass, they hit ice and flipped and hit another car. And two of the three girls in the car were killed, and the family they hit were injured but sent home the same day. And so, although I don't bring 8x10s of those girls, I wanted to bring that to show you their pictures, too. There were more than 1,000 people at the funeral we had for the boys. Some of the schools had to just drag what was left of the kids into the gym with a few teachers because they couldn't even hold classes. Everybody was at the funeral. The girls' funeral was in the morning, and the boys... personally, it tore my life apart. At one point, I thought I was having a heart attack. 2 days after they died, I had chest pain. I was 34 years old. I didn't know where my daughters were for 2 weeks. I just know people took care of them. They were there somewhere. I'll remember 2 weeks pretty much, little bits and pieces. I got a divorce. this was the straw that broke the camel's back for my marriage. My older daughter, we all went into depression. My older daughter was hard to recognize, but she really had a rough freshman year, and we finally chalked it up to depression, put on some medication, she's really come around. She couldn't be here tonight. She has far too much homework. I wouldn't let her come. My youngest daughter, Ashley, will talk a little bit. She was 7 when her brother died, and they were very, very close. Ashley, at 8 years old, had a suicide plan. I didn't find out for 2 years that she actually had a plan. I knew she talked about it, and I got her help, and she takes antidepressants also. But of all of us, I thought it was going to kill her. I really did. My husband hasn't come with me when I've done this because he can't talk about Brett. A lot of fast talking to get him here tonight. He said that he'd come, but he's not going to talk because he can't. He wouldn't understand a word he had to say. He would cry all the way through it. And Brett was his only child. He lost everything in that accident. We feel that we trained our boys to drive and trained them well, but it still comes down to inexperience. It still comes down to being a teenager, you know, and the things that teenagers do and their immaturity and their it's not going to happen to me attitude. I had the same attitude. This wasn't going to happen to me. If I could spare one family with this bill, we've had to endure losing our boys. It would all be worth it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Moore. My son Justin was my only child, and he was killed in a car wreck on July 4th of 1998. He had gone with 3 friends. They were going to go camping at Silver Lake. We live in Junction City. These were 3 boys that he goes to church with, and they left on Friday, the 3rd of July. And I'd asked him who was driving, and he had told me Kyle, who was the 18-year-old boy that was going with them. Well, Justin didn't really lie to me because Kyle did drive to pick Justin up and then took him over to the friend's house where all the boys got together. And they decided to come home Saturday night about 9 o'clock from Silver Lake so that they could go to church on Sunday. Thank you. And about 5 miles from our house, Jason, the boy that was driving, who was 16, who'd had his license a little over a month, fell asleep at the wheel and hit another car head-on. All of the boys in the car were wearing their seatbelts. Jason and the young boy behind him, who was 16, who were the 2 that died on the scene, Justin was sitting in the front seat. He lived for another hour. And Kyle, the 18-year-old that was sitting behind Justin, is all right. He's doing okay now, but he's had to go through quite a bit of therapy, and he has a plate in his head, and he would probably set off any metal detector at any airport. I was woke up by 3 sheriffs at 3:30 that morning. It was a Sunday morning on July 5th to tell me that my son had been killed and 2 other of his friends. I can't tell you what it's like. It's just been a nightmare. Before I came here today, I went to therapy, and then I went to my son's grave. I really feel that if this bill was in place, it just wouldn't have happened. I had already set down rules for Justin. He'd had his permit for 5 months. He was 15 and a half when he died. I had already told him that he would be driving with me for a year before he got his license, and that we would be following the same laws that they had in California as far as graduated licensing. My sister lives there, and her kids have really not had any problems with it. I had a friend the other day that had been saving articles since 1988. There's 10 articles here. 33 kids were killed in these 10 articles. In December of 1988, there was 3 kids killed, Junction City, and a 66-year-old man that they hit. There was 6 other kids killed in one car south of Tarrington, and there were 4 other kids killed in another car wreck. That's 13 kids in 1 month in 1988, and I just think, why didn't anybody catch on to this then? It's really important to me that this gets passed. I have no other kids. I have nothing to gain from this except that nobody else has to go through this. It's horrible. It's like, please, please work this bill and do whatever you can to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? 10 V8.
We appreciate your testimony. Can you tell us what time of the day or night the accidents happened?
My son's wreck was at 11:30 at night.
Uh-huh.
And our son was at 10 minutes to 11 on a Friday night.
Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is the bill says on page 2, line 19, limit the hours not to drive between 12 midnight and 5 a.m. And I just thought sometimes it gets pretty hazardous. Even 9 o'clock in the evening, it is raining hard or snowing. I just wonder, what is your comments or opinion? If we move it up to 9 or 10 in the evening,
you know,
or would that be too early?
I'm really tough. If this were my bill and I wrote it, nobody'd want it. I have a 16-year-old driver. I wish she could be here to say what I do to her. I don't think that the first 6 months they need to drive after sunset, but I guess some people would get excited. My understanding is that 12 a.m. to 5 a.m. is curfew anyhow. I don't have to deal with that because my daughter's not out at midnight. But I think it would be beneficial for earlier. I just don't think that it would be supported.
Mm-hmm. And what is your opinion?
My opinion is that...
Mrs. Moore?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Sandra. I think that the reason that midnight was put into this is because of the kids that are working at Taco Bell's and McDonald's, and they don't get off work until later, though there is a stipulation in this for employment. In my personal opinion, 11 o'clock is what I would say. I mean, if I could do it, that is what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because I think Madam Chair, follow-up question. The previous witness mentioned something about an accident at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I just wonder whether it will be safer to make it 9 o'clock, but there may not be support for it.
Well, we can have you in the drawing up. We can talk about it before we work
together.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. And I haven't seen that part, but what about who can be in the car with you? I was trying to see if this bill actually would have affected, because it's before midnight, and because that's what a young man told me, said that bill wouldn't help those two women, but just today, because he, and would it?
Senator, bear in mind the young man that was driving it only had his license a little over a month, so none of those boys would have been able to be in the vehicle for him until he had had his license for 1 year.
This says, You have to have it for a year.
Yeah. Right.
The second, because
it excludes family members.
Right, because that's what I said, and they said, well, what is, he said, what's the permit for that year? If you, you know, a child's been driving with a licensed driver for a year, sure, they may have gotten 50 hours here. Even though they just had their driver's license, they may have had their experience in. But still, this says that there just wouldn't have been that situation either one because they weren't related.
It would have been in our incident. Fred had had his license 5 months. So for the first 6 months, nobody but family members.
Okay.
All three of these kids were non-family members.
Okay. So what if you...
Okay. Mine wouldn't have affected it for mine, but yeah. The number of passengers would definitely...
Okay. Does somebody else have a question? Okay, hon, what's your name?
My name's Ashley Graves.
Okay.
And I'm 11, and my brother died when I was 7, and when he died, I don't remember a lot, but my Aunt Pat came down, and she really took care of us, and my mom was always in the bathroom crying, and then I, like, miss him a lot, and he was 15 when he died. Yeah, I think this is a good thing to do because it helps stop all the teenagers that are dying.
Okay, hon. Good. Anybody have questions?
I just want to say,
okay, yes.
We appreciate your coming, Ashley. This bill may not help your brother, but we hope that it will help a lot of other teenagers like your brother. So thank you for coming.
And Senator Castillo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank all three of you as well. I know it's very painful to go to talk about this again with us and come and do it in public this way. And I know you're doing it because you want to help other people. And I really appreciate that. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Colin Elliott. Okay. And Janet Gamby. And Lisa Millett. And Brett Stout, I want to thank you for coming too, even though you didn't talk. Thank you.
My name is Janet Gamby, Parish Hammond and Committee. Appreciate your staying with us late in the evening. Colin asked me to go before him. That's where I am. I'm sorry. When our 16 and a half year old son died, our daughter, baby daughter, was the age of little Ashley from McKenzie. And one of the things that's coming is just an example of I don't have to, I mean, you'll see for yourself. Anyway, you've got the yellow sheet. I'm not going to repeat things on it. It's yellow for Justin. Justin was my son Gabe's best friend. Gabe was invited to go on that camping trip. I was out of town, and especially my husband said no. Gabe was younger, and I had been over to the driver's home about a week right after he got his license. He invited my son to go to the beach with him, and I said, on the front, you're going to drive to the coast? And he just got his license. And my son didn't understand why not. Oh, just Jason was a very good driver now. And I went over to Jason's house. And, I mean, I love Jason. We have no problem with Jason. It's just I went over to his house. And they were playing basketball outside. And I said, you guys, I need you to understand that Gabe cannot drive with you. We have rules in our family that we have to drive for several months before we can even take a family member. And I would like you to not ask anymore, because it puts pressure on me between Gabe and me, because Gabe agrees with you. He would go on a dime if we would let him go. Well, they didn't go to the coast. They ended up doing the other thing. We can have rules and families and things, but the pressure continues. And I want to talk a little as an educator. Kyle, by the way, the fellow that broke his thighs and has the plate, and he had lived with us until 2 weeks before that accident. He happened to live with us his senior year in high school so that he could graduate. And so we're indirectly involved in lots of ways. But I want to refer to a statement that the principal at Springfield High School said some years ago, talking about the problems with, you know, the delicate teenagers. And he went like this, pointing to the window, which showed the enormous parking lot outside of Crescent Central High School. And he said, the problem is, we can't compete with that. Now, what he meant, I think, is just a very, very important thing. Education should be considered, for teenagers, his or her life's work at that time. It's as important as an adult's job is. Now, it's not more important to be tooting around in a car when you don't have a clue what you're doing, even though you think you know everything. It's distracting from studies. Colin is here. This is more important. He didn't drive. He came with some adults. What he's doing today is a lot more valuable in his development than if he were out purposelessly driving around. And I don't know. I'm from the 50s. I don't know when the 16-year-old thing happened, but I would like to know more of the history of it, but I can only assume that when 16-year-olds were allowed to drive in Oregon, it was work, family aid, and otherwise related, because we didn't have cars. I mean, this was before the 50s that the bill took in effect. There were children, for some reason, that needed to be able to drive their parents' cars at certain times. But things have really, really changed now, because in the 50s, there were a few hot rods that we all coveted, you know, we all thought that'd be so cool to have. We didn't have cars. I mean, our parents carpooled us to Corvallis High School, and we walked home, and it wasn't any big deal. It was several miles, but it was fun, and it was exercise, and it's just what we did. If it was snowing, I'm sure somebody came and picked us up. I mean, you don't really appreciate it at the time, but, I mean, we weren't thrown to the dogs by not being able to drive. On occasion, if we planned ahead of time and were acting responsibly, we could borrow the family car if it were convenient with our parents. We weren't given cars. Today, the parking lots for the children are so much bigger than the faculty parking lots, and instead of studying and doing homework, they're out there thinking. They're using it as a tool to develop independence, and that is not how you develop independence. That's how you have a false illusion of dependence, of independence. And I want to relate to some of my own teenagers. I mean, we've had a lot of them. And we've had several ASB presidents, who've had many team captains, musicians, soloists, you know, first violinists, you name it. Not one of, and they've all been honor students, not one of my children would have supported this bill. And they're great kids. I mean, they were doing mature, good things. Teenagers want to know who they are, and they want to be independent, and that's part of the process. But it's education and skill development that develops independence, not just having a toy to drive around in. I should say, too, that
Our son Benson did not die in a car. We have a car that we never repaired after he crashed it when he was 16. He died in a therapist called it after his called it accidental suicide, which was a term I hadn't heard, but it's a very common thing that's happening. If I'm 16 and I don't really know who I am and what I'm doing and don't feel good about this or that or whatever, and I'm out in a car and I'm driving too fast for thrills, that's another form of accidental suicide. It's not deliberate, but it happens when we don't have a purpose in our life. And I point out the things about our own teenagers, because even though they're doing good things, they oppose this bill. But I'm the parent. And I know that one of the reasons that they're doing good things is that they don't have a car just for every other reason or to do just every other thing that they want to do when they're 16 years old. It would help families like ours very, very, very much to have kids so that we aren't out in the pasture looking like idiots, you know. Because we're not critical of other people. We just don't want our 14-year-old driving with a 16-year-old. Why should he that's just learning to drive? There are plenty of other important things. They need to be otherwise occupied. I would like to show you another picture of Hanson. He was a great kid. He is a great kid. We were struggling very hard in our family with some pressures that dealt with the state medical board, and our son was, his death was related to that. But I bring him in because he represents teenagers. I mean, there are teenagers that have a lot less problems than we do at the time, but they're very big to the teenager. And they need to be studying, and they need to be working through these things so that those things aren't so big to them. And like the other mothers here, it's just no fun to have a hat instead of a kid. And I just really hope you support the bill and help. There's nothing sacred about 16. It's just something that, you know, that was passed at one time. I think at a time when people were more responsible and had more purpose for their driving. And thank
you.
My kids aren't like Collins.
Good evening, Chair Shannon and members of the committee. My name is Colin Elliott. I live in Junction City and I go to Junction City High School. I was friends with some of these boys. First of all, I write for our school paper. I didn't know that I would be able to bring some to pass around, but I brought this one anyway. And here's the first issue of the year after Justin, Jason, and Stefan died. And we had a graduated licensing article that I wrote just because there was a potential that this could happen. And then, ironically enough, you know, you turn the page, and right there we have a whole editorial on the death of those two boys that were our friends. It's kind of sad, you know, because, well, I guess you're not going to find many 16-year-olds that support this bill. You know, I'm kind of the diamond in the rough on that bit. You know, I think it's a good idea. It doesn't do much as far as affecting, like, hampering my life in any way. Some of the major responses that I got when I wrote this article, our senior class president said, it sucks. It takes away your ability to have fun. Well, I guess, but here's some of the parts of this bill that I highlighted and I said how they affected my life. If you turn to Section 1 on the very first page, Article C, it says, has an instructional driver permit issued under ORS 807 that bit for at least 6 months prior to application of the license. Basically, right now, you can get your license the very same day. I mean, boom, you get your permit, get your license just like that. And I have a metaphor. Our mascot at Junction City High School is a tiger. And if you bring a tiger in from the wild and you raise it, you're going to have to raise it to go back into the wild. You're gradually going to have to incorporate elements of the wild into its life. Otherwise, you know, if you baby it its whole life and give it the bottle and, you know, never let it go and just throw it out in the wild, it's going to get killed. Also, if you don't nurture it at all and just put it out in the wild without any wild experience at all, it's going to get killed as well. So gradually, you're going to have to nurture this baby tiger cub with some professional guidance and then a little bit letting it experience the world a little bit at a time for it to successfully go back into the wild. And you can definitely compare that to this law. The next article in that section, Article E, says, complete a driver's training program approved by the department under Section 4 of this 1999 Act, all of that. I took driver's ed and passed it, with flying colors and all that, but as far as driver's ed taught me, it taught me quite a bit more than my parents probably could have, just because it was more technical, you know, how to parallel park and right-of-way and things like that, that maybe my parents wouldn't have known that I would have needed to know. And so I definitely encourage that part of the bill, and it's definitely a necessity for kids my age who don't have, like, driver's experience. I mean, like I said, right now, you can get your license the same day you get your permit. I mean, it's crazy. The next part I highlighted was under Section 3, Articles 1, 2, A and B of those, talking about Article 1 talks about how for the first 6 months you can drive one member of your family under 20 years of age, and for the second 6 months, good evening, Chair Shannon and members of the committee. My name is Colin Elliott. I live in Junction City and I go to Junction City High School. I was friends with some of these boys. First of all, I write for our school paper. I didn't know that I would be able to bring some to pass around, but I brought this one anyway. And here's the first issue of the year after Justin, Jason, and Stefan died. And we had a graduated licensing article that I wrote just because there was a potential that this could happen. And then, ironically enough, you know, you turn the page, and right there we have a whole editorial on the death of those two boys that were our friends. It's just, it's kind of sad, you know, because, well, I guess you're not going to find many 16-year-olds that support this bill. You know, I'm kind of the diamond in the rough on that bit. Basically, you know, I think it's a good idea. It doesn't do much as far as affecting, like, hampering my life in any way. Some of the major responses that I got when I wrote this article, our senior class president said, it sucks. It takes away your ability to have fun. Well, I guess, but here's some of the parts of the bill that I highlighted, and I said how they affected my life. If you turn to Section 1 on the very first page, Article C, says, has an instructional driver permit issued under ORS 807 for at least 6 months prior to application of the license. Basically, right now, you can get your license the very same day. I mean, boom, you get your permit, you get your license, just like that. And I have a metaphor. Our mascot at Junction City High School is a tiger. And if you bring a tiger in from the wild and you raise it, you're going to have to raise it to go back into the wild. You're gradually going to have to incorporate elements of the wild into its life. Otherwise, you know, if you baby it its whole life and give it the bottle and, you know, never let it go and just throw it out in the wild, it's going to get killed. Also, if you don't nurture it at all and just put it out in the wild without any wild experience at all, it's going to get killed as well. So gradually, you're going to have to nurture this baby tiger cub with some professional guidance and then a little bit letting it experience the world a little bit at a time for it to successfully go back into the wild. And you can definitely compare that to this law. The next article in that section, Article E, says complete a driver's training program approved by the department under Section 4 of this 1999 Act, all of that. I took driver's ed and passed it with flying colors and all that, but as far as driver's ed taught me, it taught me quite a bit more than my parents probably could have, just because it was more technical, you know, how to parallel park and right-of-way and things like that, that maybe my parents wouldn't have known that I would have needed to know. And so I definitely encourage that part of the bill, and it's definitely a necessity for kids my age who don't have, like, driver's experience. I mean, like I said, right now you can get your license the same day you get your permit. I mean, it's crazy. The next part I highlighted was under Section 3, Articles 1, 2, A and B of those, talking about Article 1 talks about how for the first 6 months you can drive one member of your family under 20 years of age, and for the second 6 months, three members of your family. No friends, of course, under the age of 20, which makes good sense because, as you can tell, these kids that were killed in these accidents were my age and were friends mostly of the people who drove them. You see parents like Susie and Janet, and I just have a statistic here that has to do with that. In 1996, it's rather old, but 1,539 people were killed in accidents involving 16-year-old drivers. Now, if you think about it, you have their families, and then you multiply that by 1,539, and it's kind of devastating if you think about it. And this law, I mean, yes, it may take away some of our fun and a little bit of our freedom as teenagers, but, you know, that's 1,539 families that don't have to go through that every single year. And that's just 1996. I'll bet it's increased, you know, by now. The second part of that is it talks about how it's okay, you know, if you have a job and you need to drive in between the hours of 5 and 12 a.m. I have a friend, his name is Tyke. He has a job where he works until 2 a.m. And so he's probably 20, but he has this job when he's 16 or 17, you know, he's going to need to get to his job. And that was another big complaint I got when I wrote this article, people saying that they wouldn't be able to go to their work if their work's late. Another thing it talks about is it's okay if it's a school event in which no other transportation is available at Junction City High School. I don't know if you read the sports sections of your papers, but if you do, around football season, you know that we're really big on the state playoffs and winning championships, and we're a football school. And we have some schools in our league, like Lapine and, for instance, Glide, where they're 2-3 hour trips. And so you're going to have to, you know, football game ends at, say, 9, 10 o'clock. And so you're going to have to be driving back late at night. And this thing covers so that that's okay if there's no other transportation, which doesn't hamper that part either. The last little bit that I have to say is the day that I got my permit was probably one or two days after those three boys died. And it's weird sitting there on the computer, you know, filling in little blanks that they probably filled in and wondering, you know, I could be out there just as easily as that. I could be just another statistic. I could be just another son who died because of, you know, ill experience as far as driving and things like that. You know, it's not really fair. On the way up here, Janet had said to me, you know, don't do this to your parents. Don't. And I said, what, die? And she was like, yes. And there's so many other people that are affected. This, you know, tore apart our community when those three boys died. I'm sure it was similar results for those kids in Lebanon. And every time this happens, and you know what? It's not worth it. It's not worth it just to, you know, say, oh, well, it limits my fun or it limits my freedom. You know, it also limits people's lives, and that's what's important. That's my testimony.
Well, Colin, I just want to thank you for it.
Thank you very much for hearing it, Senator Sharon.
I just want to say 20 years ago, I was there. Somebody else was here. I hope 20 years from now, you're here. You're a level-headed kid. We need you. Did somebody else want to say?
Colin, yes. What do you think if we move the curfew time from 12 midnight to 9 o'clock? Because 9 o'clock, if it's dark and rainy or icy, it could be pretty dangerous too.
Yes, definitely. As far as that, I think if you listen to Susan's and Susan and Renee's testimony, both of those accidents happened when they drifted across the line, and I think this was probably because they both fell asleep at the wheel, and that was it. No, he didn't. Well, Jason, the driver of Justin's car, fell asleep at the wheel, and that had to do with the wait times, but I think it's not a bad idea, but I think that if it's early enough at night, I mean, really, teenagers, we just start getting going at 9 o'clock, so I think we're pretty energized and ready. But the main thing I think that needs to be worked in this law is the amount of experience, because I'll admit, when I went into driver's ed, and even when I was out of driver's ed, I still didn't know anything. I mean, we think we know everything because we're teenagers and we're invincible and, you know, nothing can stop us, but really, we don't have the necessary experiments, and death can stop us. And as far as those hours go, I think it wouldn't necessarily be wrong or right to limit them. I guess it just depends on, as far as statistics and personal experience. My personal opinion is I can understand 11, maybe 10:30, but I don't think 9 o'clock. But I do understand that bit about like conditions like sleet and freezing rain and things like that, because those conditions greatly increase, you know, the amount of stuff on the road and just more stuff for you to run into and get hurt from. So yes, I would say that's probably a reasonable idea.
Mrs. Gandy, do you have an opinion if we move it to 9 o'clock?
I think it'd be terrific in that, first of all, who told them they couldn't have fun without a car, and why did they believe it? Well, as parents, we let them believe it because we keep allowing all of this, and as estate persons. Also, teenagers too, they are getting going. You know, calling them over, they get going around night. A good place to get going is in somebody's family room, in their home. You don't have to get going a car. I think it would be great. It would help law enforcement. Who would it not help? Most kids, now I know there are exceptions, and I think exceptions, any good law makes exceptions where they're needed, but most kids that I know are only working like for that car or that insurance or that gas. It's just a vicious circle.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really that productive.
Mm-hmm.
And there's another, as we all know, 50 years to work on paying for cars. There's more to do when you're a teenager.
Dear Mrs. Miller?
Yes. Yes. And members of the committee, I'm Lisa Miette from the Oregon Health Division, and I'm the manager for the Child Fatality and Injury Prevention Unit at the Health Division. And I guess if I were to add a couple of things to the things that have already been said, they would be that one of the groups that I work with across the state is the Child Fatality Review Team, the statewide one and the one that exists in every county. And those teams are made up of district attorneys, law enforcement officials, SCF employees, victims assistance folks. And every child that dies in the state of Oregon, their case is reviewed by these folks. And every year we publish a report, and last year it looked like this, and you may have one if you don't, I'd be happy to leave one for you. But one of the major recommendations that came out of the reviews last year on child fatality was that we needed to enact regulated driver's licensing in Oregon, and that was across the board. So I wanted to share that with you. So there's a lot of support for this bill. At least from that system, and it's a multidisciplinary system. And then the other thing would be to draw your attention to the second page of my testimony and point out that research on effectiveness of GDL indicates that there'd be crash reductions between 5 and 10%, and that's conservative. Earlier tonight we heard a representative say 23%, and if 5 and 10% would be equal about 130 to 260 kids, 16 and 17-year-olds that wouldn't end up in injurious or fatal crashes every year. If it was 23%, that would be 590 kids. So this would have a significant impact, not just on kids, but on their families and all the people that they're acquainted with. I guess the other thing that I would talk about is draw your attention to the fact that lately there's a commercial. One of the big car dealers up in the Portland metro area has introduced, and we were talking about it outside earlier, and it says that the most effective safety equipment in your car is another experienced driver. And they have a picture of a teen, and it's one of the best things I've seen on TV lately about safety and children. I'm really aware of the fact that I was here this morning testifying on suicide prevention with youth, and I'm really aware of the fact that when we have these high-risk behaviors that end in fatalities and injuries with young people, particularly teens, a lot of the risk factors that put them in high risk for motor vehicle crashes also put them at risk factors for things like suicide. And so when we talk about reducing risk behavior and monitoring teens' behavior after dark, setting limits that make sense, improving the ability of parents to make good choices in counseling them about them, setting some laws that gives us some guidelines, we're not only reducing risk around automobile crashes, but other things too. So I wanted to say that to you. And we want to encourage you from the Health Division to support this bill, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here and speak.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Right. Is it Randy? Did you call?
Not yet.
Okay, thank you. Any more questions for this panel? Okay, thank you, each of you. And Randy Pellegrini and Mike Sherlock.
Good evening. My name is Mike Sherlock, and I'm here tonight representing the Oregon Traffic Safety Education Association, which is an association of high school driving instructors, and I took the liberty to bring Tim Dorfelt with me, who's one of the board members of that group, and a working driver's ed teacher, so he backs me up on those technical questions that I don't know about. The Oregon Traffic Safety Education is strongly in support of House Bill 2440. I'll skip a bunch of stuff that we have on my books. I forgot to pass that in my testimony. But I'd just like to, you know, highlight a few things. One of them is there is really strong support for 2440. A recent poll of Oregon AAA members published in their Oregon Motorist magazine shows that 87% of their members polled support the graduated driver's license. 76% favor a teen driving curfew of 11 p.m. to 11 or 5 a.m. And 84% responded that a teen driver should not have passengers unless accompanied by an adult over the age of 25. And the point here is they have a broad membership and they very strongly supported this. During the interim, our group worked with DOT and other transportation safety advocates on several bill proposals designed to establish a better education experience program for Oregon's new drivers. And while each of those individually was a good idea, we feel that House Bill 2440 incorporates all of those good ideas into one bill. We further believe you all passed out Senate Bill 1118, which increases the amount of money that goes to driver's education. You should know that yesterday that passed out of the House Transportation Committee unanimously. We feel that those two bills combined provide an integrated program that has been proven to be successful in other states, and so we really strongly urge your support. A couple of questions that I heard, one of them is regarding the hours for the curfew. The only no votes that were heard on the House side were people who felt that the midnight to 5 a.m. hour restriction was too restrictive. And we worry that if you move it too early to 9 o'clock, maybe 11 o'clock would be useful, but some people are concerned about restricting the rights of these teenagers, and so it came to you know, an agreement that 12 o'clock seemed to be a good compromise time. So, Senator Yee, that maybe answered part of your question on that. As a matter of fact, on the House side, the Dash 3 amendments were actually proposed 1 a.m. Curfew because some members of the committee felt that midnight was too restrictive, so you should consider that. The amendments that you've received tonight for this bill, we haven't had a chance to look at them very long. We just got them right before the meeting. The intent of the amendments is to transfer the administration of driver's education from the Department of Education to the Department of Transportation. Mm-hmm. There's a history behind that. In the last session, the department, there was agreement between the two departments that that was a good idea. And the reason for that was the Department of Transportation feels that they have a very strong safety program. For instance, their motorcycle safety program has proven to be quite effective. They want to take the ball and run with it and do a good job with it. Our group, the driving instructors who've worked with them, have felt that the Department of Education, to be frank, was more interested in transferring the dollars than they were really administering the program and making sure it was a good, solid program. So our group strongly supports moving the administration, including the money side of it, from Department of Education to Department of Transportation. And then I guess just one last final note. Some of the people who have concern on this bill are concerned that this replaces strong parenting with statute. And our group does not agree with that at all. What we feel is this bill helps parents be strong parents. Sometimes it's really tough to tell your kid, I know all your friends get to go driving around until midnight, you know, until 1 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm. I don't want you to do that. It's a real strong tool for a parent to say, not only don't I want you to do that, it's against the law. So be home by midnight. Mm-hmm. And all the other restrictions we feel are tools to help parents be strong parents. So with that, I'd be happy to talk.
Yes, I have one question. I noticed the term traffic safety education. Why the switch from guard to sheriff?
I don't know. I noticed that, and maybe Tim knows.
I don't think there's an easy answer, Senator Shannon. It's more of a national trend to say we're not just teaching driving. There's pedestrian safety. There's awareness of seat belts. There's airbag knowledge. There's all issues of safety, not just driving. And it is kind of a national trend being passed down.
But it clearly encompasses driver's ed.
Oh, definitely. Driving, safety, and the word education.
Okay, any other questions? Are these two? Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. Senator Shannon and Senators, I've been a teenager myself one time way back when, and I'm surprised I made it out of my teens. My mom has raised us four boys, and she didn't have much control over us. I now have a child of my own, and she's a teenager. I've actually assisted teaching driver's ed classes numerous times for insurance portions. I called back the earlier teachers for that. So I've helped teach these driver's ed courses. I work in the insurance industry on a daily basis, working with insurance agents underwriting and drivers that come through all the time. I know from my own experience, teenagers definitely present a problem for the driving community, and they've got many challenges at stake. Actually, I'm here tonight representing myself as a very concerned parent of a soon-to-be licensed young driver, showing my support for this graduated licensing program that we've got available to us. In my experience, I see two problems with teenagers and drivers. There's the immaturity and the inexperience. Graduated licensing can reduce these. From the information I've said up to here today to you, I've done some studying on it on my own just because to present some of these classes from the insurance perspective. And I thought that the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, which I took a lot of their graphs from, represents that well. And there's a graph in there. It's S6, where nighttime crashes in the U.S., 95 and 96. I think it answers your question, Senator Mayhew's yes. question regarding the nighttime crashes. By the appearance of the chart, over 70% of the crashes, nighttime crashes for 16 and 17-year-olds happened between the hours of 9 and midnight at night.
Between 9 and 12.
See it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which column is it?
Right. And 16. That's 9, 10.
That's 10.
And 10 to 11.
Oh.
And 11.
So it's a very high percentage. Are you talking about 27%?
Correct. Though it's unlikely we'll ever really truly eliminate all injuries and fatalities caused by young drivers, teen drivers, we've got a good start with this graduated licensing program here for us today. And by being here tonight, I hope I can help, you know, just showing you my desire to bring this forward and to know that this program has saved lives in states where this has been enacted and you know, potentially could even save my own children's lives one day at some point. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Question.
Yes?
Madam Chair. So who prepared the statistics on?
This is, we were prepared by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. They have a actually an excellent email location, a website. If you did locate them, they have some wonderful statistics on young drivers. Actually, this presentation was given to a group of insurance companies by Julie Roachman, the Vice President of Communications for Insurance Institute Highway Safety. I've since modified this and can be giving presentations to insurance agents throughout the state. I think it's important information that they share with their parents and their drivers. If you have any further questions on this, I'd be happy to connect.
Could you explain the next page after
reduction of crash involvement?
Mm-hmm.
It's based in my written testimony. If I may, I'll read that.
Sure, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that would be F8. Graph 8 shows consistent significant reductions in crashes among 16-year-olds in states with nighttime driving restrictions. The reductions range from over 20% in Louisiana to about 70% in Pennsylvania. These are great numbers. Nighttime driving restrictions that start earlier, like 9 or 10 p.m., produce the greatest reduction in teen crashes.
Chief,
I'm not sure. Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Thank you. I was wondering, Mike, since you followed this over on the House side, was this kind of information talked about on the House side, that when you do lower the curfew hours, that you could capture, you know, reduce a higher percentage of the...
It was talked about, but there were just people who felt that, you know, it's an American dream, you know, American graffiti, grab the girl and head out on a summer evening, and we want to restrict that as little as possible. And so, like I say, it kind of ended up, there was one proposal to be at 1 o'clock, and some people wanted earlier, and they finally all compromised on midnight.
I'm sure. Even though it's a temporary, because this is only for, what, the first 6 months or year that you have your license, that you would have to deal with the curfew?
It would be for the first 2 years.
For the first 2 years.
As long as you're under 18.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Senator DeCillo, if I could just add to that the six-month restrictions, which are wonderful, includes, of course, curfew hours. And the issue that they brought up over in the House side was, don't cities already have curfews? Doesn't the state already have curfew? Why are we adding another curfew? So this is kind of a paperwork issue. And we did cover some of that, and I mailed a package to you back in March, Senator Shannon, the national statistics similar to what this gentleman has just presented that talks about GDL. And they find that many cities put tighter restrictions than states and even the legislators. That, for example, I teach in Dayton and McMinnville, Senator George's district as well, and they talk about 10 o'clock and 10:30 on weeknights. So, kind of looking at a city and how important it is to infringe on a city's rights, et cetera, and that's where they said it got too complicated to go into.
Senator George.
Randy, on behalf of your mother and those of us who have had teenage drivers of our children, we are glad that you've entered that point of penitence that you will serve and show your children is on.
And I'll come back. Thank you.
Okay. I just want to ask you, so they were saying in Pennsylvania, where there was the highest reduction, 70%, that they restricted it to 9 o'clock?
I do not have a specific statistic here with me tonight, but I can give you that information.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And if we could even do it till 17, it might help you. What's that, Senator?
It says 16-year-old drivers during curfew hours. So what is the curfew hours in just Pennsylvania?
He didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know that offhand, but I can get that at that. Okay.
But you would think that they'd probably be from the 9 to 10 to just go higher.
That was the impression that I got from
the entire result.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
The issues that were discussed in the hearing in the House, is there any discussion of relatively rural versus urban settings for these restrictions in driving? And the reason I bring this up is that I'm sure in Idaho they have a 14-year-old graduated driver's license, and it's a daylight license. And the reason they have adopted that daylight driving license is because many of the communities in Idaho are separated by distances that are relatively remote, And young people grow up learning how to drive farming equipment, mainly tractors and combines. And they often help on the farms and ranches. And often equipment may be several miles distant from the field that they'll be using them in, and they drive them from a base ranch or a home farm barn to the fields that they're going to be working in, and that involves the young person driving on a county highway or a state highway, on a farm vehicle or even a licensed vehicle, a farm truck. But the folks in Idaho figures that those 14, 15, 16-year-old drivers were licensed to drive to and from school or a job or during daylight hours only. Are you familiar with those kinds of restrictions?
Yes, we are familiar with that. There was no discussion on the House side regarding the 14-year-old part of it, but there was discussion regarding the farm driving, and it was felt that the exclusions for kids that are driving to and from work, like if they're going out to the field with a tractor or something, they're driving to or from work, would include that, or kids who live out in a far away place and are coming home from some the school dance or something, that's covered also. So when we discussed it, everyone felt that the rural interests were well met with this.
So there's exemptions, Madam Chairman, in the bill for to and from work,
yes.
Mm-hmm. To and from school,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And home. And to and from
home to school, home to work.
That's where it's
all work to a friend's house.
Right. Right. No, seeing grass on
I thought it's intelligent, no matter where you went, you had to drag to bed.
That's been eliminated in many cities.
Madam Chairman, Grant County, which is one of the counties in the state of Oregon, we have one traffic system in the county. The population density in the district that I serve, which is all part of 11 counties, is 0.17 persons per square mile. And so eliminating the ability for teenagers to drive virtually eliminates their mobility because parents cannot get in a car and drive kids sometimes an hour one way. From a base ranch or home farm barn to the fields that they're going to be working in, and that involves the young person driving on a county highway or a state highway, on a farm vehicle or even a licensed vehicle, a farm truck. But the folks in Idaho figured that those 14, 15, 16-year-old drivers were licensed to drive to and from school or a job or during daylight hours only. Are you familiar with those kinds of restrictions?
Yes, we are familiar with that. There was no discussion on the House side regarding the 14-year-old part of it, but there was discussion regarding the farm driving, and it was felt that the exclusions for kids that are driving to and from work, like if they're going out to the field with a tractor or something, they're driving to or from work, would include that, or kids who live out in a far away place and are coming home from some the school dance or something, that's covered also. So when we discussed it, everyone felt that the rural interests were well met with this.
So there's exemptions, Madam Chairman, in the bill for to and from work,
yes.
Mm-hmm. To and from school,
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And home. And to and from
home to school, home to work.
Right, so there's
all work to a friend's house.
Right. There's no seeing grass on
I thought it's intelligent, no matter where you went, you had to drag to bed.
That's been eliminated in many cities.
Madam Chairman, Grant County, which is one of the counties in the state of Oregon, we have one traffic system in the county. The population density in the district that I serve, which is all a part of 11 counties, is 0.17 persons per square mile. And so eliminating the ability for teenagers to drive virtually eliminates their mobility because parents cannot get in a car and drive kids sometimes an hour one way to an event, maybe not an event that involves school, or to visit friends. So I'm a bit conflicted with this bill. I'm moved by the testimony that I heard this evening. And I don't have any question about the potential for the all the curves to cross, inexperience, exuberance, and unfortunate mishaps. It happens that one of the largest causes of teenage fatalities in the district in which I serve is single car accidents, and they're related to speed and experience and weather conditions. With all that notwithstanding, kids of 16, 15, and 16 years old in much of the Wheeler County and Grant County and Baker County and Dillon County and places where time and distance are real factors, and parents are already stretched to the maximum capacity to make a living and hold a job. A teen driving is not an option, not an optional pursuit. It's a necessary function. So I'm wondering, how do I go back to the district in which I serve and explain to the parents that that there is a provision that exempts to and from school and to and from work, but no other in terms of the graduating license. I think it's a great program. I have a daughter who has her learner's permit, and on Mother's Day, which was the last time I was at John Day, one of the things that we did together was take a driving lesson. We took a drive, and my daughter was driving, and I was sitting there with both hands in my mouth. But, I guess the question I've got for you is, this seems to make real good sense in an urban setting. It doesn't seem to make very much sense in a very rural or even remote setting. Can you help me with this?
Now, Chair Senator Farioli, prior to the session, when we were putting together all of these details in the bill, there were quite a few people from many different groups that were there, including some, I can't remember the exact, I think it was a person from the Farm Bureau, but I could be wrong on that. But they brought up those same questions, and when we were all through, they seemed comfortable with the bill as is currently written. And in the building, I've talked to people from, those groups as well, and they haven't had a problem with it.
Maybe I should schedule it for Wednesday so you have time to look it over more.
Oh, Madam Chairman, I think I don't think my vote in this instance would stop the bill from moving forward.
No, I bet. So in case you weren't coming up with an idea, you might want to amend that.
You want us to accept the remote area of the state?
Madam Chairman, I think trying to tailor a bill like this to every circumstance is probably wouldn't be successful. I guess making certain that the public record reflects the exemptions for school and work will be at least helpful. And I guess the question is, the school-related activities, are those included also?
Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the people, Renee, just pointed out that we need to be sure that we understand what we're talking about, that this does not restrict those teenagers from driving. It just restricts them from driving between midnight and 5 a.m. or with big carloads of kids that aren't related to them. So it's not that they're, that suddenly these kids aren't just allowed to drive. It's just they can't drive, in the first year with big carloads of their buddies, and they can't be driving between midnight and 5 a.m.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to ask you guys, Kelly Taylor from CMV.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I didn't see you on the sign-up, but I was hoping to hear from you.
I was home. The seat was gone by the time I got here.
Okay, good.
But I thought you'd give me a shot. And I
that's all right. Hi, Tony. Hi. This must be the last panel. Because none of you are signed up.
Madam Chair, members of the city, I'm Kelly Tater, Department of Transportation, and with me today is Troy Casal, our Transportation Safety Director. Yeah, I wanted to touch base on a couple of things. And Senator Farioli, I wanted to add, you know, I was going to mention that it's really the driving restrictions are between 12 midnight and 5. And I wanted to let you all know that there is a provision, it's been on the books for some time, for both a student permit, which is really a driver's license, or an emergency permit, which is really a driver's license, for 14, mm-hmm. if it's necessary, like if there's no other transportation for school, or if their driving is part of the needs of the family to help support the family, which could be like working the ranch or something like that when it's necessary for the family's livelihood that this teen drives. So, and a lot of times what that where we see those is in the rural areas. So it's kind of similar to what Idaho has. So I thought that might help as you're working through the bill that, to know that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And so I'm just going to touch very quickly to make sure we're all saying the same thing about what this bill does. If I were a teen coming in to get a driver's license, these are the things I would need to meet. I would have to have an instruction permit for 6 months prior to my application. I would have to have at least 50 hours of supervised driving with someone 21 years or older that had 2 years of driving experience. And I would either have to have completed the driver training program or have 50 more hours of supervised driving, which helps kids who maybe can't afford driver's ed, or the classes are full, or it's not available in their area. Okay? And then once I got my license...
Just a second, Senator Castillo.
Thank you. So how do you know that they'd had this? How do you know that they'd had this many hours?
Madam Chair and Senator Castillo, they're going to certify it with their parents as they're signing the application. It's going to be part of the certification process when they're getting their license.
Thank you.
The new restrictions. Now, when I get my license, the restrictions that are placed on me is in the first 6 months, I'm not to have any passengers under the age of 20 who are not a member of my family. And in the next 6 months, between 6 and 12 months, I'm not to have more than 3 passengers under the age of 20 that aren't a member of my immediate family. So I can still have immediate family any of that time in that year. But while I'm under the age of 18, I'm not to drive between midnight and 5 unless I'm going to and from school events when there's no other transportation available between home and school, and when I'm driving for employment purposes. So that's not while I'm driving on a job, but going to and from my work. I could still drive between 5 and midnight in those circumstances. So, like when I grew up part of the time on the McKenzie River and the school was at one end of the river and my home was at the other, if the bus wasn't available and the school game had gotten out late and I'd gone to the homecoming dance, I still could have gotten myself home. So, if it had been after midnight. Now, most of these elements we believe will have an obvious positive impact on safety. And I'd like Troy to touch on those because he's pretty familiar with the different pieces that we'll definitely have. We know from studies, we know from stats, the pieces that we know will make a difference on saving some lives and injuries.
Good evening, Chair Shannon, yes. Members of the committee. My name is Troy Casala, Manager of the Transportation Safety Division for ODOT. This bill, if passed, heard some of the stories and some of the other statistics provided earlier. The primary piece in this bill is with the passengers. We are going to have an impact on deaths and injuries, not only with teens, but with others in that car or in other cars involved in the crashes. First priority is with the passengers. Nighttime, when looking at the statistics for the state of Oregon, between 12 and 5, the numbers aren't huge. In fact, the numbers are larger between 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. But between 12 and 5, when you look at the number of crashes that are there, the severity is higher. The trauma is higher. And that's why these hours are selected. All of the reasons behind teen driving crashes will never be explained. And this bill isn't going to eliminate all of those unfortunate incidents, but it's going to make a difference. It's going to have an immediate impact. Our estimate will be around 10 to 15 lives per year and more than 200 injuries per year. And that's an estimate. There's no science to it. It's based on what other states have done. This bill is slightly different than other states. I would also like to add, and I shared this with Representative Montgomery and Senator Trow before the session started, I received a call from the National Transportation Safety Board and their chief or their safety recommendations division is willing to come and testify and put their support behind this bill as they've done in other states. They also shared with me that there are some unique aspects to this bill that I match very well with problems that the District of Columbia is currently having with their teen drivers. They have already taken this bill in its current form off of the website and have it in front of their delegate, and I don't exactly, you know, this legislature delegate, but they've taken the language from Oregon and are currently debating it this week because it helps address some very specific problems that they have in their area.
Tony, what do you think about the new amended one? Do you have a chance to look at the amendment?
No, Chair, have briefly. The people have been able to look at this.
I'd like your, if you have a chance to look at it, I'd like your opinion.
Transportation is a life skill. If you think about your day, Madam Chair, there's nothing that you accomplish during the day that does not involve transportation. With this license and through driver education and training programs, our hope is that that life skill is passed on successfully and we make a difference in the enforcement numbers in the state.
Okay.
I'd like to introduce Dr. John Tung. He's the chair of the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee.
Well, welcome again, Dr. Tung.
Chair Shannon, members of the committee. Thank you. My name is John Tung. I'm a practicing orthopedic surgeon from Tualatin. I live and work in Clackamas County, which has a disproportionate number of the fatalities of its population. Regarding the comments regarding the rural concerns, the trauma death rate outside of the Willamette Valley by population is 10 times what it is in the Willamette Valley. The gist of this bill is that it would have spared me the worst day of my life, which was in mid-August 1963 when I was hit broadside on Division and rolled in my compact car down Division, hoping that I would be alive when the noise stopped. And the noise didn't stop because my car was rolling, and I didn't know that. And I was seriously injured, and the boy hit me, and as well as my own experience contributed to that crash. I don't call them accidents. So I have a real personal interest in this, and I've been following this, and we've had several meetings regarding this bill, one at Meeting Park Hospital where I practice. The time issue that we've been discussing, we feel... I know Representative Montgomery told me he'd like 9 o'clock, but I know that from a practical political standpoint, your job is to, you know, work with what is possible, and I would hate to lose the bill over something that minor, because if you look at the statistics, as Troy said, the greatest risk is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the 12 o'clock time, I think, would be much more acceptable to my 16-year-old daughter, who's discussed this issue with me at great length. I audited her driver's ed class this past year and was very impressed with the class taught by Mr. Miller in Lake Oswego High School. She's a 30-hour class. And I would like to comment on the amendment, which I just saw briefly, which names the Oregon Transportation Safety Committee as consulting in the process. I would be very enthusiastic about supporting facilitating efforts that our committee could make in that regard to enhance the standards in the curriculum. I think a lot of the lack of benefit of driver's ed classes in the past is due to the ineffectiveness of the courses when you come up against the culture that has shown the average teenage high school driving boy 100,000 beer commercials with cars, beer and women in the commercials. It's tough to break through that genre, that culture. So I think that we could work on that and deal with the invincibility and the inexperience. My specific concern, most of my comments, which are in your packets and were written previously and sent to Chair Montgomery's committee, have been addressed, and I appreciate that very much. The one comment or recommendation that I did make was regarding the fact that the bill, I think, could be improved and clarified by simplifying the ages of the different supervising portions of the bill. We have 21, 20, and 25 ages scattered through this bill. And I think it would simplify the bill, make it more understandable, make it easier for police officers, and make the supervision in terms of the maturity level better without any significant restrictions at all by using the age of 25, which is the age for accompanying a licensed driver. Also be the age for supervising driving, and the minimum age for a passenger, which is currently under restricting only under the age of 20. That way, I think people would understand the bill, and I think it would be a stronger bill. And I would be very concerned about
Dr. Chan?
Yes.
What would those changes be? What line?
Line 15.
Okay. Change 21 to 25 on line 15.
And line 20.
And 20.
And then the
page one of the AM book.
On the passenger restriction side, we have 20 and 20. Troy's helping me here. That's
line 9.
No, page 2 would be line 14 and 17.
You change both of those to 25?
Yeah, so the bill will be consistent throughout and be understandable to everyone. If I just submit that comment for your discussion.
Okay, you will.
I think that, as you know from actuary studies with insurance companies, the risk due to the maturity level improves tremendously at age 25. So that would be a natural cutoff. And 10 years later, you can run for president. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, yes. Mrs. Taylor.
Thanks, Senator. I just wanted to add something on the amendment. I know that in the past, when this discussion has come up, there's been concern from the folks that are in the school that have the classes and stuff to see if it moves from Department of Ed to Department of Transportation, and Department of Transportation adopts rules on the curriculum, the teacher standards and stuff. Is that going to make it so hard that our teachers don't qualify, or would it price the program? And I talked to them a lot about this. On the side, and I told them I would put on record what I'm about to say to help them understand where we would come from on this. I don't know if you remember them talking when we were here talking about the fee increase bill, and they were talking about what schools they hire, and they hire a lot of times, they contract with the private driving schools to do their training for them. Well, what they didn't realize is we license those schools, and so we're already setting standards for the same people they're using for a lot of their teachers. And so obviously, if they're using those people, we haven't priced it out or made it too tough for people to become teachers. And I said, I also, when we were writing the rules many years ago, maybe 8 or 9 or so or 10, I was the manager of that particular area over the commercial driving school, we involved them in writing the rules. We brought the teachers from the different schools from around the state and had some big meetings about what kind of equipment needed to be in the cars and what sort of stuff should be in the curriculum, and we actually got their input to help us draft the administrative rules that guided the program. And we also used Department of Ed's teacher standards on what sort of things we didn't want an instructor to be convicted of if they were going to be with kids. So the same thing they were screening teachers for as far as kidnapping or rape or something that was under criminal history, we had that same sort of standard in our rules. And I said, you know, it's been my practice and it's been Troy's practice when we've been involved in programs to do an involvement thing with the affected parties. And I said, for example, we just revised the disabled person parking permit, and we called in some disabled community groups and some law enforcement groups and some of the parking volunteers to help us make the placard a better placard and more secure and something that they thought would work. So I wanted them to know on the record that we have a good solid history both with driving schools on involvement and how we got our standards and the fact that they're actually using the standards and didn't even know it. And even with something as small as a form change, we've gotten into this, pull the people together and help us design something that works best for everybody. And I just want you to know that should that amendment go forward, that's Troy's and my pledge to you.
Good. Everybody's comfort level. Well, thank you. Yes.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions.
Sure.
To the doctor, first of all, you mentioned that there was a tenfold increase in the number of fatalities in rural areas. Could you explain how that actuarial table works and what you're referring to?
Madam Chairman, Senator Farrell, the study I'm referring to came out of the Department of the Neurosurgical Department at OHSU. And it was done on the basis of the number of deaths by population, and it was county-based, and it was very striking, and this is a study that's several years old, but it was, the reason it was important to me in particular was that in the implementation of the Oregon Safety Belt Law, which I was the chief petitioner, when we were planning the implementation, we had limited dollars to use as incentive grants, and because of that study, we targeted rural police agencies and very effectively raised use rates in those communities, and it was a great use of the resources in allocating that limited amount of money. So that's how I became aware of that.
Okay, another question?
I didn't have a chance.
Go ahead.
Was there a corresponding decrease in fatalities and in serious injuries as a result of increased use of CEQA?
I don't know what the relative shift was in rural fatality rates versus urban fatality rates, to follow up, which is probably really your question. Was there a significant reduction in fatalities? Yes, and I have a bar graph that I'll share with you when we're over with this, that the immediate reduction was felt by the disability riders, the standard insurance company, who contacted me. It was felt by State Farm, who sent a rebate check within 6 months of the onset of the safety belt law, with a sudden 30% increase in use rates. And those use rates have continued to rise. It's now at 87% statewide. This is one of the top four or five states in the nation.
And the final question, not for the doctor, Madam Chair. The agency currently in administration of the driver ed program, Department of Education, and they are reimbursing the schools at the rate of $150 for students.
Did they have that much?
If we're transferring the agency designation to the Department of Transportation, will that change the source of the funding? And if it changes the source of the funding, would that change the amount available? And would we be interested in full reimbursement of the cost for driver ed, which is twice the amount that we're currently reimbursing?
Well, we're hoping that under federal safety guidelines that we'll just have this wonderful money from the Fed. Federal safety, I'm kidding. Go ahead, Troy.
Senator Chair, Senator Crayoli. The account used to currently pay for its staff and then reimbursement of the programs under the amendment, it appears to be that's an entire shift. There was another bill previously heard that would raise the fee collected from $2 to $3, therefore a 50% increase in the funds available to reimburse the schools. So if the average has been $130, that you would hopefully see about a 50% increase in the amount that is being dispersed. In reference to the federal fund that Chair Shannon is referring to, it would be my intent to use some of those incentive funds that we have received to plug into this program where appropriate and applicable from the federal funds, because every dollar that any $2 fee that's raised is brought in that you can leave in the main account to reimburse the schools, is that much more that goes to the schools. So some of the administration of the program, I would hope you're able to fund with federal funds, leaving that state fund to go to the schools for distribution.
May I ask a question? Just to know you go back. Right now, does the Department of Ed take their administrative costs out of that? And you are saying you probably won't need to do that?
Madam Chair, I believe current law or process allows them up to 10% for administration, and I do not believe they are reaching that 10%, so they are being efficient and putting as much money into the account disbursement as they can. My intent would be to try and take some of that piece and use applicable federal funds.
Great. Lenny, do you have anything else?
No, that's, I was hoping for that kind of an answer. I guess the question I'm not quite clear on is the source of the funds for the driver's ed reimbursement through the surcharge.
Yeah.
On what?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, original driver's licenses and renewal driver's licenses. Oh. All drivers pay towards it, regardless of age.
And that fee's just been increased.
And it just passed the House.
Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, it just came out of House Transportation, headed to the floor.
Thank
you. Shelley, you may know the answer to this, but I believe that still you can be licensed to fly an aircraft at 14. One of the things about that is very similar regulations to what's contained in this bill, and that is you will fly 50 hours by yourself with an instructor. And I asked my instructor as a student pilot way back when, I said, why is it you can't fly anybody in this airplane, you know, now that I can fly by myself? And he said, because if you kill yourself, we want it to just be you. And the point was is that that is a serious consideration. You need that experience. You do dumb things. Even as an adult who's learning to fly an aircraft, you find yourself experimenting. I can think back as I was doing that, remembering driving, you know, and I had great experience because I wrecked my first car at about 8 years old. So it went way back. But a little bit too much experimenting went along the way. But the point of this is that you're ensuring that before you put at risk someone else, you know for a fact that you can safely handle that vehicle. You've demonstrated that. You're still alive, so you can carry someone. And so I really appreciate that time period and being in there. I agree with you. I think it will reduce the numbers.
Did you hear the chair?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. I had one question on the amendment. I know not everybody's had a chance to look at it, but on page 9, it goes into winter recreation parking permits, and I'm wondering how that is that supposed to be in here, dealing with this program?
Madam Chair and Senator Steele, that's simply the statute where all these different funds are mentioned.
Oh,
good.
All right. I was wondering, how is that?
What are you going to do there? That's the next bill.
That's right. Okay.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Thank you. Now, then we're going to close the public hearing. And I don't know about this man from a woman from D.C. that said they wanted to come.
Madam Chair, he was ready at the invitation. We just have on
okay.
Two others.
Oh, you did. Okay. Yeah, you did. Well, we did. I thought you'd run, so we'll talk to you later. Okay.
Sorry, he does not want to hold up the bill of which we're going to be voting for.
Right, okay. No. Fed take their administrative costs out of that, and you are saying you probably won't need to do that?
Madam Chair, I believe current law or process allows them up to 10% for administration, and I do not believe they are reaching a 10%, so they are being efficient and putting as much money into the account disbursement as they can. My intent would be to try and take some of that piece and use applicable federal funds.
Great. Henry, do you have anything else?
No, that's, I was hoping for that kind of an answer. I guess the question I'm not quite clear on is the source of the funds for the driver's ed reimbursement through the surcharge.
Yeah.
On what?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, original driver's licenses and renewal driver's licenses. Oh. All drivers pay towards it, regardless of age.
And that fee's just been increased.
And just passed the House.
Madam Chair and Senator Ferrioli, it just came out of House Transportation, headed to the floor.
Thank
you. Kelly, you may know the answer to this, but I believe that still you can be licensed to fly an aircraft at 14.
One of the things about that is very similar regulations to what's contained in this bill, and that is you will fly 50 hours by yourself or with an instructor. And I asked my instructor as a student pilot way back when, I said, why is it you can't fly anybody in this airplane, you know, now that I can fly by myself? And he said, because if you kill yourself, we want it to just be you. And the point was is that that is a serious consideration. You need that experience. You do dumb things. Even as an adult who's learning to fly an aircraft, you find yourself experimenting. I can think back as I was doing that, remembering driving, you know. And I had great experience because I wrecked my first car at about 8 years old. So it went way back. But a little bit too much experimenting went along the way. But the point of this is that you're ensuring that before you put at risk someone else, you know for a fact that you can safely handle that vehicle. You've demonstrated that. You're still alive, so you can carry someone. And so I really appreciate that time period and being in there. I agree with you. I think it will reduce the numbers.
Do you have a chair?
Yes, I did.
I had one question on the amendment. I know not everybody's had a chance to look at it, but on page 9, it goes into winter recreation parking permits, and I'm wondering how that is that supposed to be in here, dealing with this program?
Madam Chair and Senator Steele, that's simply the statute where all these different funds are mentioned.
Oh,
oh, good.
All right. I was wondering, how did that...
What are you going to do there? That's the next bill.
That's right. Okay.
Okay, thanks. Okay, thank you. Now, then we're going to close the public hearing. Okay. And I don't know about this man from a woman from D.C. that said they wanted to come.
Madam Chair, he was ready at the invitation. Which I passed on to others.
Oh, you did? Okay. Yeah, we did. Well, we did. I thought I'd go talk to you later. Okay.
So he does not want to hold up the bill that we're going to be forward. He just wants to vote for
it. Right, okay. No, but I think we have enough questions. We're not going to work until Wednesday. Okay. So I just want to let you know. We'll do it Wednesday, I think. It's not a work session.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2440, and thank you again, everybody that came.
Madam Chairman?
Yes.
You're not headed into a work session, but I'd like to make just an observation for the record.
On this bill?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'll reopen this public hearing on House Bill 2440.
I want to join my colleagues in appreciating the commentary and the testimony that the parents brought here this evening. I think it's compelling. I think I'll hear a lot of arguments. Matter of fact, I got a sheaf of letters from high school students at Baker City, and so I've written back to all of those students my support for this bill. I'll be voting for this bill. I'll be happy to speak for this bill on the Senate floor. It seems to me that the issue is just so compelling. We need to do something here, and I'll be happy to join my House counterpart from the district, which then my family and I share. I very often found his arguments to be compelling, and I find the parents' arguments here today to be extremely moving, and I am glad to contribute to moving this bill forward.
Thank you. He said if you move nothing else that we sent over to you, please work this bill.
Thank you.
The last time we talked about it, but we're going to get more input.
Oh, we're okay.
Yeah, we're going to get some more input.
Madam Chair, can you ask staff to prepare possible amendments?
Sure.
And we have work session. We can discuss the amendments, whether the committee likes the idea or not. I kind of like to move it up to 9 o'clock. As a matter of fact, I feel they shouldn't drive when it stops. So, we can prepare the amendment and see how the committee members feel, and also prepare an amendment to amend it to 25 years old.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I marked that on my
list. We're looking to move the restriction from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m.?
From 12 midnight to 9 p.m. So from 9 p.m. to 5 a.m.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Oh, we got trouble. Okay. She will draft something. Okay, does anybody else have suggestions? Okay, then we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2440 again. You may be excused. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We have one last bill. House Bill 2200-A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2200-A increases the statutory cap on winter recreation parking permits, the third snow park permit. The cap of the fee would be increased to $5 for 1 day permit, $10 for a 3 day permit, and $30 for a summer. It also increases the fine for parking in designated winter recreation areas without a permit from $10 to $30.
Okay. There's a man that I was talking to, right? Tim? Okay, I don't see you on what you say. What? Oh, there it is. Charles Weiser. Okay, right. Would you like to come up? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you said right. Madam Chairman and committee members, thank you for allowing me to come up. I have a unique opportunity in being here because as I signed up tonight, I signed up as neutral to the bill. My name is Charles Weifer. I reside in Eugene. I've owned and operated the Willamette Pass Ski Corporation for over 17 years. During that time, most of it, we've been in the snow park program. And I view the snow park program as a very beneficial program overall to the public that travel all over the state, let alone just the ski areas. The reason I'm neutral on the bill, though, is because I believe the snow park system should be a partnership between the public, the operators, and ODOT. And over many issues, I have high scrutiny of ODOT and its ability to work in good faith, and that is my biggest concern. So when they present a bill, House Bill 2200, which came directly from ODOT, that's where I say it gives me an opportunity to come before you. I'm in a situation right now where ODOT owes me money for services that I provided to the general public. Their claim is that they basically terminated my agreement, therefore they can't pay me for time after termination. I don't believe that that's a real valid issue, and we may have to pursue and test that issue. But the main reason I did come up is that I wanted to, present an amendment or a group of amendments that would keep this from happening, what's happened to me, from happening to somebody else in the future. Basically, it just adds a little bit of oversight to the current bill. The snow park program, as I said, is a good program. I don't think it's probably not beneficial for me to read through all of these amendments right at this point, but one of the key issues is that there is an advisory committee that is appointed to oversee all of the snow park work. Yet, since it's an advisory committee, there is an issue of whether they have a certain amount of authority or not. And I think that if under my amendments on Section 3, which is the second page, if we could add to ORS 810-170 items 4 and 5, I just believe that it would help specifically with the problem that I've had with ODOT.
What is the problem you had?
As a snow park contractor, I plow my logs. And then the state...
Wait a second. Who owns the lots?
The United States Forest Service.
Okay.
And that's generally the case, but there's probably county lands and maybe state lands such as timberline, the national park, to those types of things. But
well, if you have a ski area and the Forest Department owns it, what's ODOT's part?
Well, the law, when it was originally brought forth, when we created snow parks are not just for ski areas, but they're for parking in areas that need care. And so the Highway Department is the one that generally provides that care. In my instance, which is not the only instance, I'm actually referred to as a contractor. I actually do the work in lieu of ODOT doing it, and then I get reimbursed. The situation in this particular case, again, would be that the dilemma came up that the ODOT wanted to put a limit on the amount of money that I could plow. That limit was far less than any amount that I'd actually used before. So therefore, I told them that I couldn't do that, and I wanted to negotiate in fairness with them. The contract that I was under was a contract that was in perpetual, except it had a 30-day cancellation clause. When I tried to negotiate with them, I continued to operate, and I sell to the general public a permit they put in their window. Many of those permits are considered annual permits. And so annual is from November through April. So the situation is, as we moved along in this process, and the Highway Department basically said, no, we're not going to negotiate with you. And by the way, we're giving you notice that we're canceling your agreement. So we won't be reimbursing you at all. My situation here is I can't stop plowing for my guests. I can't stop plowing for the people such as that have bought an annual permit. They believe that they bought something that is still yet to be delivered to them.
Did they want you to plow for free?
Well, I'm not sure what they would, you know, their position would be is they would say, well, we could come and plow it. But the history has been is their priority is always the road first. And so they don't get the parking lot plowed. That's the reason we are the contractor. And that happens in many places.
Did they ever try to come up with their own plows when they said you're not going to do it? Did they ever try and plow the parking lot?
Well, they help me sometimes anyway. I mean, it's a cooperative thing. But as far as their resources, and that's really why this bill's in front of you, their resources are stretched. The dilemmas that I still, probably the part that makes me the most angry, though, is as they tried to cap my rate, they doubled their rate. And so I look at it as they take money from one place to put it in their own.
What do you mean? They doubled what they charged people, but then cut you back?
They doubled their, you know, I'm using doubled as not an exact number because I've not been provided those exact numbers. But let's say their plow rate was, you know, $100 as an example to run their own equipment, such as a rotary plow. And then the next time that they actually were during this exact same time, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of close to $300 for that same work. And they found out that there was a problem because I basically came to some of their meetings and was upset about this. And they reimbursed the fund $238,000 during the same period of time. But it's yet to be known if that's a correct amount. They just kind of said, oops. So that's why I still have such a, you know, I'm very critical of their ability to administer the monies that they are entrusted with to provide this service. I believe that if the Winter Advisory Committee had more authority, such as to authorize whether funds were dispersed from the fund or not, and to make sure that that if an agreement, right now the law, prior to this bill, the law states that they have to consult with the advisory committee in order to contract with me, but it doesn't say that they have to consult to terminate me. In this particular instance, they didn't consult with the advisory committee. They did terminate me. I went to advisory meeting, and all of the advisors basically unanimously, you know, instructed ODOT to renew my permit and to compensate me for the services I already provided. ODOT, though, doesn't have to follow what the advisory committee says. So they haven't. And I'm still out $7,193 from over a year ago. They actually held $10,316.25 for that period of time, but they just recently funded $3,000 and some.
Did they pay you interest for using your money that time?
No. No, and, you know, my my attorney's bills have been more than this during the same period of time and trying to fight with them, which them...
They have attorneys representing them in any of the courts or whatever?
It's the Attorney General's office. So,
So I know, but I mean, that's just gas tax dollars going in, and in the end they paid you.
So, you know, the long and the short is that, you know, I believe that it's very important that the... I think it's just very important that the highway department has somebody that is actually scrutinizing what they're doing with our public dollars. They're here asking for higher citations and a higher snow park fee, which both of them are justifiable, but somebody needs to be watching how those are being used, and that's what hasn't happened over the years.
So what your amendment would do would strengthen it so that whoever does the hiring or recommends the hiring would be involved in the firing.
That's correct. If the highway department would have gone to the snow park committee and said, hey, you know, we don't like what's going on, such as at Willamette Pass, what should we do about it? I think that there could have been a continuing negotiation and everybody would have worked through the issues. Instead, they just, you know, terminated. And in the existing Oregon law, they can't open any snow parks or enter into those agreements without consulting the committee. But yet, it's an oversight that it doesn't say they also should have to consult with the committee to pull those permits. And that's what I'm trying to put in here under item number 5, the last item. It just says the Oregon Transportation Commission shall only change or modify any authorities or agreements granted under ORS 810-170 after consultation with the Winter Advisory Committee established under ORS 802-350. Right now, if you read, it'll say that they have to consult to actually enact, but they basically, you know, acted to remove me without consulting the committee. And when they did consult the committee, even to this date, has recommended to them on every single meeting since this happened to, you know, take care of my situation. But they refused to. And so...
we're going to have them up there. I just wonder why they don't want to pay you if you did the plowing.
I'd like you to ask them.
Okay. Could you just sit nearby?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah. I have a couple questions.
Sure.
Madam Chairman, the question I'm curious to me is that how close is the snow park to the facility that Mr. Weber operates?
They're one and the same. There's actually other snow parks close to us also.
And I was wondering if the parking lots are kept cleared and serviceable during the entire operational season of the other recreational facilities that are there.
I'm not sure I understand the question yet.
Can you state, Madam Chairman, the ski area has a limited number of days it can operate. You got a snow season and then you're out of business. And it would seem to me that people that want to recreate in the snow who bought a snow park permit have an expectation that the park permit entitles them to park in a plowed, safe area. And I'm just, I guess, wondering whether or not the keeping the recreational opportunity open is keeping that parking lot cleared and serviceable every day.
Yes.
That you're open, and
yes,
every day that people want to go recreate in the snow.
Yes.
And so there's a continuous plowing requirement there.
That's correct, 24 hours a day.
Okay. And I'm just wondering if the Oregon Department of Transportation made an arbitrary decision that he was plowing the parking lot too much. He basically said, you're out of here.
Yeah. No, like I said, you know, probably some of those questions would be great to pose directly at, like, the Winter Advisory Committee. I think they have a pretty good handle on how both the contractors and how the state are performing their duties. I don't believe any of us have a concern with the actual performance of the duties. We have a concern of the money of the duties. It's what takes place between the work being done and the amount being charged for that work and reimbursements happening. In my case, no reimbursement happening. In the state's case, them getting $300 an hour for something that I'm only charging maybe $95 an hour for to do the same. And so there's some homework that's going to need to be done, and I just want to be sure that nobody else suffers from what I'm suffering through.
Yeah, and Chairman, the other question I guess I have is that was there an indication of dissatisfaction by ODOT prior to the cancellation? Was there an ongoing dispute? Was there any indication that there was dissatisfaction with performance, or was there a restatement of an issue that was between
There have been disputes. Some of the disputes range exactly as you said before of access to lots. We have several lots on our premises, and we do not allow people to park in all of the lots on all of the days. And so there were issues along those lines, but in talking with the Forest Service and with the Winter Recreation Advisory Committee, which is actually looking at prioritizing, it's accepted in the managed lots for us to, when somebody drives in to say, we would like you to park in this zone, even because we may actually be doing plowing in the other zone, so we have to control the cars. So there was a dispute over that. But there was no dispute over the funds. An example would be that the real issue came. One of the issues was some of my discoveries from ODOT's records. On August 14th, 1997, they had a maintenance budget team meeting, and Karen Morrison's report. One of her reports was that. It says, Karen Morrison addressed the team and informed them where the snow park program is from a budget standpoint. She has the numbers that each of the regions have budgeted based on the past 5-year averages charges to the snow park program. The revenue from the program comes from the sale of permits. Historically, the revenues have exceeded the expenses. So as recently as in August of 97, the system has had more revenues than expenses. And reserves have been built up. It says in the last 3 or 4 years, revenues have kept up with expenses, and we are getting to the bottom of that reserve. Reasons for that include increased snow removal costs, such as equipment costs. Ski areas that are being contracted out are hitting the snow park program relatively hard. For example, maintenance crews were not always charging snow parks. So I'm not, again, this is her writing, but it says ski areas that are being contracted out are hitting the snow park program relatively hard. I am a contract area, and I am a ski area. So I assume she's talking about me in August of 97. She also states that surfaces are deteriorated. It says from a program standpoint, the permit fees will increase, and we'll make an attempt this winter to contain snow removal costs. Karen will be updating the snow removal agreements within the week, and will be adding a maximum in each of the agreements. She will leave a blank line for the districts to fill in as their budgets are created, and they can allot a certain dollar amount to each snow park. So she's going to limit me, but she's going to let the districts set their own amount. And believe me, the revenues all still come from the fees. So she will add language in the contract that states the contractor cannot exceed that amount without prior written approval from the department. Contractors should be itemizing a certain number of hours for each piece of equipment. The team determined that it is difficult to administer. Karen stated that if we can raise the revenues and contain the cost in order to build up a reserve, we will make money available for servicing. I'm not part of ODOT, but I don't know what making money available for servicing is when we're talking about a true user fee to the public for a certain job. The money should only be used in those realms, and if there's an excess, that excess should stay in the fund. The other situation along these same lines, as we're talking about, you know, how I was being restricted, that was right when I basically received the new agreement, was told to sign it, and I tried to negotiate with them. The ability for me to negotiate was that I just said, I can't accept the level of cap that you're putting on me. And my historic costs have always been well over that. Another thing the committee should know is that my ski area is a net provider to the snow parks fund. We've always sold more snow parks than we draw out to do the work. So we're a net provider to things such as way out in the rural areas where there may be a snow park. Some of my skiers are funding the plowing that's going on at some of those spots. In the winter of 96, I don't know what the origin of this document is, but in the winter of 96, my costs were $25,425. In the winter of 97, my cost was $34,810. In the winter of 98, it was $24,417, which almost half of it was not paid. And this last winter, which is the biggest winter in my lifetime, it did cost us $44,000 to plow those lots.
And how much were you paid?
We're under a current agreement that is in effect, and they have been paying me. So we're not in a current dispute. We're on a dispute on the prior. When basically they, through the Winter Advisory Committee's help, Karen Morrison, the administrator, said, if you'd like a contract like Timberline's, you know, we'll go that way. And so they gave us a contract that looked substantially like Timberline's, and I said, fine, and we signed it. So we've been under contract, which is basically shows here that our current contract was at $57,000, and that was the cap they put on, and the snow removal cost is the $44,000. Those numbers are correct, but some of these others are not accurate compared to my records. And that's even one of the concerns I have overall is that the snow park fund in the history has been doing relatively well, and it's been taking care of the public, and it's been taking care of the ski areas. It's been working well. The crunch came because of a shift in some priorities, and the crunch may be ahead of us still. And so we all need to be more, just more scrutiny needs to be brought onto it. And I would just think it'd be a mistake for us to raise the fines and raise the fees to the general public if we're not just as responsible with how we actually administer the program. I believe that with the Winter Advisory Committee and ODOT putting in the effort to supervise it, it can be correct. So I don't oppose, as I've even written in my, you know, in my amendments that I've handed you, I mean, most of this language is their language. I've just changed a few things. Specifically, I just changed that I think no matter what, if somebody actually gets a fine, that some money should go back in the fund. Number two, I just state that the amounts that they are proposing. what the origin of this document is. But in the winter of 96, my cost was $25,425. In the winter of 97, my cost was $34,810. In the winter of 98, it was $24,417, which almost half of it was not paid. And this last winter, which is the biggest winter in my lifetime, it did cost us $44,000 to plow those lots.
And how much were you paid?
We're under a current agreement that is in effect, and they have been paying me. So we're not in a current dispute. We're on a dispute on the prior. When basically they, through the Winter Advisory Committee's help, Karen Morrison, the administrator, said, if you'd like a contract like Timberline's, you know, we'll go that way. And so they gave us a contract that looked substantially like Timberline's, and I said, fine, and we signed it. So we've been under contract, which it basically shows here that our current contract was the $57,000, and that was the cap they put on. And the snow removal cost is the $44,000. Those numbers are correct, but some of these others are not accurate compared to my record. And that's even one of the concerns I have overall is that the snow park fund in the history has been doing relatively well, and it's been taking care of the public. It's been taking care of the ski areas. It's been working well. The crunch came because of a shift in some priorities, and the crunch may be ahead of us still, and so we all need to be more, more scrutiny needs to be brought onto it. And I would just think it would be a mistake for us to raise the fines and raise the fees to the general public if we're not just as responsible with how we actually administer the program. I believe that with the Winter Advisory Committee and ODOT putting in the effort to supervise it, it can be correct. And so I don't oppose, as I've even written in my, you know, in my amendments that I've handed you, I mean, most of this language is their language. I've just changed a few things. Specifically, I just changed that I think no matter what, if somebody actually gets a fine, that some money should go back in the fund. Number two, I just state that the amounts that they are proposing is fine. It's just that I changed their word from consider to follow. And it puts the authority on the commission, the highway commission, to follow the Winter Recreation Advisory Board. And I've already spoke about the items on 4 and 5, and that's been most of my testimony, is because I really feel I've been wronged by people that don't care sometimes. And they do work for me. They work with my dollars, and they're appointed to, keep our roads in shape for us. And so I think sometimes it's unfortunate that you have to shake a chain or something in order to, get people to pay attention to you again. But I feel bad because that's what I feel like I have to do.
I just want to say this thing, the last, this, so as of March 31, 1999, proposed caps. The contract, that's where you feel you were hung that winter, 97-98, when the cap went down to 16.
Yeah, you can see that, that was basically a situation where it was just unreasonable for us. We immediately, when we saw that, we just said, I'm sorry, we can't sign this.
You have any idea why you went down then? Cooper Spur, is basically even, and so was Mount Hood. Mount Hood went up. Ski Bowl went up. Now Timberline went down 10,000, and Powder River went down 17. But do you know why it was so drastic that you were dropped? You really don't?
I don't know, other than, like I said, I read this August 14th, 97 report, and I can't really speak to it other than I mean, it just it's a mistake on their part. They've made other mistakes. And I guess it's unfortunate that they, you know, can make a mistake, and I think they realize they made a mistake, and it actually has come into being a much bigger issue, such as I would not want you to miss the $283,000 that I informed you about that was placed back in the fund. It was removed at one time, but it was placed back in because they, you know, under the scrutiny, some of the scrutiny that I've brought, it's like, wait, what's going on here? And my concern on that is that I still don't know that that's the right amount. The people that took it out are the same ones that said, well, I think we'll just put this much back. And I think at some point that will be discerned. It's probably a lot of this testimony is background information for 2200. It's the essence of why, you know, 2200 needs just a little more oversight to go along with it. But 2200 in general was really scary to me when I first read it. When I first read it many months ago, it basically said that the Winter Recreation Advisory Committee would only meet when it had necessary business. Mm-hmm. They were trying to remove the fact that they were required to meet four times a year. And that was dropped, I think, on the House side. This bill did not fly through with glowing colors. I think it was almost a split over there. So I think it's a situation where, on one hand, I don't sit here to kill the bill. I sit here that I just would like the whole snow park system to operate properly. And I think it has the people in place that can do that, but they need at least a minimum amount of control, and they need respect from the Transportation Commission that when the committee either asks for how much does a piece of equipment cost, how much does it cost to run, that the person would be able to open a notebook at the meeting and tell them. And in 17 years, they refused to bring that information even into the committee room.
To tell them how much it costs to operate their own snow plot?
That's correct.
I've heard this story before. Now, I want to ask you, what makes you think that it costs them $300 an hour and they pay you $92?
It doesn't anymore. That's one of the things they adjusted. I think they adjusted it down to $187 or something, and that's where the $238,000 came back. That's what's transpiring, you know, and it's getting better under scrutiny, but there was no justification for it, none. There isn't a state in North America that charges that rate. So
where did you come up with the $300 an hour?
Well, you have to ask Doug.
Well, he came up with it.
Well, he'll represent ODOT, and he can hopefully help you with that. I'm just saying we discovered that in one of our meetings, that was where the primary error was. The other error that they did is that they just double billed for things. In other words, if I submit you a bill for 2 hours, it became 4 hours. So, and all of these things are verbal discussions. I mean, I have no hard auditing records from, you know, from their files. We've written, as you've seen some of the correspondence that I've provided to you, we've written the AG on numerous occasions asking for documentation. We have been provided some documentation, but it's not really even the documentation we've asked for. They've kind of given us stuff and said, that's all we have, when it's not the exact documentation we would like to see.
Okay. I'd like to ask you a question. I'd like to see what happened, yeah.
Who is on this Winter Recreation Advisory Committee? Who is, if you want them to have more authority, I don't understand who they are and what role they...
Well, they're appointed by, even in my amendment, you know, they're appointed under ORS 802-350, which I do have a copy with me, I can leave with you. But advisory committees are recommended by the governor.
Oh, okay.
And then appointed.
Senate process, okay.
Yes, and okay. So all of the people that are on there are appointed. The law itself originally made it as there's like two ski area representatives, there's public at large, there's a ski association, there's Nordic, there's snowmobile. It's well represented as the winter enthusiast, and it has, you know, it functions very well. The concern is that I've been to many meetings where the chair will ask for information, and you can go literally years before that information will ever show up at a meeting. It will just not show up. I just believe that the ODOT looks at the advisory committee to the essence of the law. They don't have to follow anything that the advisory committee actually says other than what's in the law. And the law does have a few things, such as it says consult with them on new contracts, but it doesn't say anything about terminating the contract. So that's I go back to the exact same example. My position is that they need to be able to answer all of the advisory committee's questions. If I was on the advisory committee, I would feel uncomfortable if I didn't know how much it was costing at each individual lot to run highway equipment. And so, you know, some of that stuff is coming out in the last year, but it hasn't been coming out at the individual meetings. It doesn't give them anything to make a decision on. So, kept in the dark.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Did you have something?
Yes, Madam Chair. The other day on the floor, a comment was made by one of the senators relative to a bill that was requiring ODOT to develop a cost-accounting system, and the person made reference to a belief that he had that ODOT has had a cost-accounting system that we could determine these costs at any time in the past, and yet we've asked the same question for at least 2 years relative to what does it cost you to remove snow, and I've had a really difficult time getting to that number. Do you believe that, have you ever seen anything that indicated to you that in the past we had anything that would have been able to indicate to you the exact cost of doing an operation and the cost of operating that piece of machinery per hour, per day, per whatever?
It's just starting to come out, but no, my answer is no. I don't, as I sit here right now, and I've been to virtually every meeting other than your telephone meetings for several years now, you know, if you ask them how much does it cost to, you know, or how much do you bill for a sand truck? We've all seen them, you know, with the sand in the back and the plow in the front. And they refuse to give us that information. They have it. They know it. They always say something like, well, we cost it in a very difficult way. We put labor over here and we put equipment over here and we have reserves here and we do leasebacks and we do trade-ins and so we don't know. And I would say that, no, they know. They know if it's $57.32. They know that. And they have to know that because the fund gets hit, but it gets hit in bulk. You know, we'll see, you know, $300,000 go out from the fund, transferred over. So how come? We all know the plowing happens, but how many hours? What equipment?
More counting for the 300.
Could I do a follow-up? Yeah. Have you ever seen, like, for example, if they bill this account for $300,000 for these services that have been provided, have you ever been able to go in there and look at exactly how that was lined out to indicate how the billing?
Well, actually, just last week from the Attorney General's office
as part of our request. But as I said, it's very difficult for us to, it's really not our request, but it's along the lines of what you're talking about. It has entries for a particular site, and then it'll have a dollar value. But it doesn't, you know, if I knew what the rate was, then I could tell you, I mean, I'd have to calculate what their hours are. Mm-hmm. Because all it does is give me a site, gives me an accounting code, which they're all the same for that site, and then it gives me dollar value. Likewise, even as I've gone through this, and I'm sure, you know, believe me, I am not, you know, up to speed on their document, but, you know, I cannot reconcile the Willamette Pass, which I feel I'm intimately knowledgeable about. And that's likewise, like I said, in this document here, I did not provide you with this document, but it's like this this 95-96 amount of 19,803 is out of the blue. because ODOT themselves paid me $25,425.75. So,
when you bill, could I have a follow-up question? When you bill ODOT, are you required to give exact detail of when, where, how much?
That equipment type, hours that are used off the hour meter, date, and specific location. And one of our disputes with ODOT over the period of time of termination is that they said that they would not reimburse me this $3,000 that was owed, even though it was under the contract, because they believed that the snow did not, I mean, the weather conditions were not conducive to snow plowing on those days, and they didn't think that we should be plowing. They reconsidered that position after talking with many people, such as themselves even, with the fact that even though the snow event is not happening right at that time, you do a lot of plowing and moving. As we said earlier, it's a 24-hour-a-day operation. So.
But you are required in that 24-hour period to account for all the times that a piece of machinery. You may take a block, like on a certain day I had 10.3 hours on this piece of machinery bill of it did.
Yep. Yes, in our contract, we have contracts with the state to perform this work, yet, I mean, I guess you'd say to some extent they should have a like document mm-hmm. for the work that they're performing. I wouldn't call it a contract, but it'd be nice to know that they could say, this truck cost this much money, it was in such and such snow park on such and such day. Now, I believe they have some of that information, but it's not readily available to the committee, which is who I am basically looking to solve this dilemma. So.
Okay, thank you.
Are your attorney fees, did you say that they still owe you $2,000? Is that what it is now?
The state, you know, the wonderful state of Oregon, still owes me $7,000.
And they'd rather pay the AG than pay.
Yeah, that's kind of been, you know, I guess no pun intended, but it's kind of my way or the highway has been kind of the issue all along. But they still owe me $7,192.50. They said they can't reimburse me that because it's all monies that are outside of the contract after they canceled it. The situation, though, they did come back and say, but we did make a mistake, and we will reimburse you the $3,000 some dollars. One of their issues on, you know, they said, well, you know, it's after June 30th, it's fiscal year, and I hear all these different reasons, yet the check I just got was dated, you know, May 6th of this year for over, you know, 14 months ago's problems, specifically in January of 98. So.
Okay, well, we need to hear from Doug. So you want to move back and we'll have Doug move over or something.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry.
So let's say.
This is the south.
Yeah. I just want to ask you, when you come, Doug, are you in charge of snow removal? Or is this under your bailiwick?
Church and a member of the committee, the general maintenance engineer with Oregon Department of Transportation, yes, snow removal is under my
purview.
All right, to the bill does two things. It raises the maximum fee allowable for winter recreation parking permits. It changes the fine for winter parking violations. That's essentially what the bill does. With respect to the proposed amendments, I don't really have any concern with those amendments. I think courts may have a problem with the ticket, but I'll let them speak to that. I'm not sure an advisory committee can direct the Transportation Commission, but Legislative Council would be able to advise you on that. The other two, 4 and 5, I had no problems with. We wouldn't, regardless of whether the commission is required to follow the advice of the advisory committee on setting the rates, it doesn't really matter. We would. The advisory committee has advised us if House Bill 2200 passes to set the rates for next year at $15 for a seasonal, $7 for a 3-day, $3 for a daily. And that's what we would do.
Well, can you answer any questions that's been raised tonight?
Which one would you like? Where would you like?
Well, I would first off, okay. But Mr. Weiser, have you seen this paper?
I believe we provided it.
Okay. And do you have any idea of why this cap went down so almost cut in half? I guess it was more than cut in half. That Willamette Pass that winter, was it light?
Chair Shannon, the proposed caps were based on past costs and available what we felt was available in the fund. There was a provision on that cap that said it simply said that the cap cannot be exceeded without written authorization. And if you'll notice, I believe there were some of those other contract fee areas were paid, the caps were changed as they needed more money. The cap was set as an initial budget allocation and in one that so that we could use as the snow falls. You never know where the snow is going to land in Oregon, and so sometimes it's higher in one area and lower in another. And so we set the caps. I cannot tell you exactly how the $16,000 was picked, but there was a provision in the contract that would have allowed raising that cap upon request.
So then you're saying the next column that said the cost, the actual cost was $18,000, so you're saying they did raise it?
In?
$97,98. I don't know if I'm reading it right. This is what it actually was in the four previous. This was the proposed, and then it looks like that's what they actually spent, $97,98.
The amount that was reimbursed in $97,98, Willamette Path never signed the contract that had the cap in it.
Madam Chairman?
Okay.
If the cap contract had a provision for an escalator requested, why is there a dispute now when everybody recognizes $16,000 wasn't even enough to cover the cost of the program?
Chair Shannon, Senator Farrioli, the issue here is that we were instructed by the Attorney General's office. I believe this was a result of that bill that passed last session regarding Attorney General oversight of contracts. We were instructed by the Attorney General's office to apply a cap to each of our contracts. We never signed the contract with Willamette Pass. And when we were unable to come to a contract with Willamette Pass, the Attorney General's office was saying you have to have caps on your contracts. So we terminated the contract in February. And then subsequent to that, there was still snow removal that was occurring, but it was not under a contract with the state of Oregon. And as Tim has said, that's the reason we can't pay for it, because we can't pay for work that was done outside of a contract.
No, that's what you said, but yet he just got a check.
Chair Shannon, the check that the issue there was that there was some work that was done prior to the cancellation of the contract. We asked for follow-up documentation for that work. There was not the documentation we had was not acceptable to us to make payment. About a month ago, 2 months ago, we were provided with that documentation. Actually, the AG's office was provided with that documentation, and we got it, and we said, yep, these are legitimate costs. This was costs that were done under the contract, and we paid the bill.
Okay. Was the instruction for you to cancel the contract from the Attorney General?
Chair Shannon, Senator Farrioli, there was consultation with the AG's office. I don't remember if they instructed us to cancel the contract.
Chairman, it sounds like another arbitrary and capricious decision by the agency that harmed our contract to me, but I'm just guessing. I wonder how long has it been, Madam Chairman, since there's been an audit at the snow park fund by the Secretary of State's office.
Do you know the last time it was audited?
Chair Shannon, there's some financial audit that goes on, but I don't believe it's by the Secretary of State's office. However, given that not only Tim's request, but others' requests for scrutiny of this program, I'm requesting an audit of contract snow removal, ODOT snow removal,
and of cost a performance audit, not only just their financial audit, but a performance audit, and of the sale of permits and enforcement to be done on this program.
Who are you asking to do it?
I am taking that through. There's an ODOT audit committee, and they will either route it to, my understanding is they will either route it to a private consultant or to the Secretary of State.
Madam Chairman, I would like to see a letter from the committee requesting an audit of the authorization for withdrawals from the Snowpark Fund. Who made them and under what authority? And then the return of funds to the Snowpark Fund. I'd like to know by what agency decision and authority withdrawals and additions are made to the ODOT fund, apparently outside the normal accounting process.
Chair Shannon, Senator Ferrioli, it's not actually maybe characterized correctly with withdrawals and deposits. The fund, the issue was we set rates according to a federal procedure so that if subsequent to the floods in 96 and 97, we discovered that we did not have an equipment rate structure that was acceptable to the federal government for reimbursement. So we went through a rather detailed, to put it nicely, process specified by the federal government of setting rates. Because of a quirk in that process, the rates for the snow blowing equipment were too high for the winter that we're referring to, which is 97-98. So there was no removal of funds here. There was just actually charges made to the fund that, at a high equipment rate. It actually was not the Winter Recreation Advisory Committee that pointed this out. It was one of our own maintenance crews, because we were seeing the same thing happen not only to the Snowpark Fund, but to our own winter snow removal budgets. And we went back to try and figure out what happened. And that's when we found out that the rates were set. We discovered what the error was, and the rates were set too high. Well, we went back and adjusted the rates, and we said, well, this adversely impacted the snowpark account. And so while all the rest of the fund is just highway money, whatever got billed by ODOT to ODOT is essentially that way it works, because it's our equipment. It got billed by ODOT to specific activities. All that money stays in the highway fund, but the money for the snowpark fund, it was came directly out of the snowpark fund. So we went back and we calculated the number of hours that the snow blowers were used and what the rate should have been, and that's how the refund to the snowpark account was created.
Well, I'm sure that's a very detailed explanation for the transfers, and I appreciate that, but I guess what I'm suggesting is that if funds came out of the snowpark fund at a higher rate than they should have, they were dispersed inappropriately, and then if a reimbursement was made, it must have come from some fund outside the snowpark fund, and I want to know from where.
Chair Shannon, Senator Ferrioli, the highway fund.
Okay, and is that highway fund, are there any statutory constraints on the highway fund for the purposes that it may be put?
Chair Shannon, Senator Ferrioli, there are constraints on the highway fund. However, the highway fund recovered dollars from the snowpark fund that it should not have recovered, and those dollars were moved back into the snowpark fund.
Okay, I guess the budget notes and the authority and the authorizations for the transfers will all be a matter of record.
Chair Shannon, Senator Ferrioli, they're accounting records that have all those notes on the journal entry.
And I guess those things are the things that I would like the Secretary of State to look at. So I'm certainly a layperson. I don't have any idea what those documents would mean. But I know that if the snow park fund is to be a dedicated fund from revenues from the sale of snow park stamps, and that those dollars are supposed to be allocated to the specific purposes of maintenance and upkeep of a snow park, and there was a positive balance in the fund according to the memorandums that were read into the record by Mr. Weiper, and I wonder how we ended up with a deficit in there. It had to be reimbursement from that. And I guess I also want to know what does being hit hard mean if the removal is done pursuant to the contract.
Doug wants to answer some of those questions.
Chair Shannon, Senator Ferrioli, I'll take them in reverse order and see if I can remember the first one when I get done. The Being hit hard is simply, I don't know what why that characterization, but about one third of the snow removal of the cost for snow removal in the, from snow parks right now is contracted out, contract funds. So I guess if you say that one third of the money is going out to contract snow removal, I don't know if that justifies being hit hard or what, but
well,
that's what the number is.
Ask you a question, and that is, could you say to this man, we have no contract, stop plowing, you will not be reimbursed?